Okay, can we take our seats and get ready? We all set? If any of you, and I imagine most of you are academics, and even with the habit of writing books, I want you to imagine, if you can, writing a book, and in 150 years, you come back as a ghost, and you attend a seminar in which three lectures are given, one by a cosmologist, one by a philosopher, and one by an anthropologist, all essentially taking their idea from your book. You'd feel quite pleased. I'd feel totally astonished. But of course, that is what we are actually doing this afternoon. We have this astonishing range of speakers, but it is genuinely true that all of them, in a sense, are taking as their starting point a book written about 150 years ago. I don't think, curiously, that Darwin would be all that surprised to have a philosopher talking about his book. I mean, Darwin, let's face it, in spite of all his pretenses, was not altogether a modest man. He does have a little note, which Michael probably could get the quotation right, but it's roughly as follows. In the M&N notebooks, he writes rather cryptically, "He who understands baboon will do more for philosophy than John Locke," which suggests that he thought he had some reference to philosophy. I think I probably got it wrong. Michael Ruse, who is a distinguished philosopher, and an unusual philosopher in that most philosophers don't understand Darwin. It's very odd. I mean, I understood it when I was 15. It's a fairly straightforward idea, but philosophers apparently find it hard. But Michael is an exception to this rule and is going to talk to us about evolution and culture. Michael Ruse.
Well, I honestly thought that we were getting real modesty this afternoon when John Maynard Smith talked about the three people who were going to talk about his book. I thought, oh my God, where am I talking about the penguin, the theory of evolution written by John Maynard Smith? And I should say that, in fact, for me, it is a great privilege. Like most English people, I never did any biology whatsoever at school. When I was at school, anyway, the really bright kids did Latin and Greek. And then the middle ones did math, physics, chemistry, and German. And then what we call the late developers did geography, woodwork, Spanish, and biology. My parents pushed me long enough and hard enough that I managed to get up to the sort of second level, although I could never get up to the top level. And then when it came to PhD time, I'd done a degree in philosophy. I was looking for a sort of a suitable academic ecological niche, which means that you want an area that basically has been overlooked by others, but which has got some literature, but not too good, so that you can criticize it. And my supervisor said, well, what about evolution? I think that we should look at that. And I said, well, I don't know a damn thing about it. Well, in fact, I did. I knew Lamarckism was true at the time. He said, well, there's a chap called Maynard Smith, I think it's that, just put out a penguin on that. Why don't you go and get that? And I did. And I just loved it from the first page. And then at the end of the book, Maynard Smith said, well, if you like this book, you should look at these. And I really did. I went and got all of those out and read all of those. And one thing led to another to this afternoon's talk. So if you don't like the talk, don't blame me. Blame John Maynard Smith. My talk this afternoon is, in fact, I one is asked to give a title to one's talk. And really and truly, my talk is really evolution and its values. And with real modesty, this is to a certain extent a trailer for a book that I'm busy writing at the moment. And the question that I'm interested in is the question that a lot of philosophers are interested in, or philosophers of science are interested in, the whole objectivity versus subjectivity debate. One which, of course, as I'm sure many of you know, in North America has been given an added edge recently by the great Sokol hoax, the chappie who sent the pseudo-article off to Social Text, the trendy journal in cultural studies, and the silly buggers accepted it. And as soon as it came out, he said, well, it's all a hoax. And instead of, at that point, realizing that at times like this, what one does is one maintains a dignified silence. They try to defend themselves by saying, well, the sorts of things he was saying was better than people say anyway, and science really is subjective anyhow. So anyhow, the sort of starting point of my talk is this whole question of whether or not science is objective or whether or not science is subjective. And I'm really not doing this deliberately, because I do it in the book. But basically what I'm interested in is the position which is taken on the one hand by pretty much most scientists, with the exception perhaps of Richard Lewontin, that science really does tell it like it is. Or the phrase which I really like is the phrase which is used by the scientist's favourite philosopher, the late Sir Karl Popper, that science is in some sense knowledge without a knower. Of course, Popper and scientists realise that there are knowers, but basically what the claim is that there's no such thing as feminist science or Jewish science or English science or whatever. Science is science. Versus Levitt and Gross, who've written a very strong polemic on this, a book called Higher Superstition, argue that the critics of this position are the sort of the geriatric flower children of the 1960s, basically people in the arts, people particularly these days in English studies, cultural studies, rhetoric, sociology of science, and many other areas like that, who want to argue that in some very important sense, science is a subjective phenomenon. In some sense, science is a social construction, or if you like, an epiphenomenon of the culture of the day. And so indeed, science, just as philosophy, just as religion, just as literature, is in some sense then a reflection. I mean, one can have good reflections and bad reflections, but nevertheless, is in some sense inherently subjective. And so the issue that I'm concerned with in my book, and concerned with today, is this debate, which I do want to say is I personally think is a particularly interesting one, and I think is a particularly important one. If one's going to try to deal with a topic like this, in some sense you've got to have some way of trying to get a handle on the topic. How are you going to? I mean, how is one to deal with this other than by yelling at the other side and, you know, writing funny remarks about the other side and doing all the sorts of things that academics really enjoy doing? And basically, what I've tried to do is, and I again, I'm not being original in this. I would want to suggest that in major respects, although and in the end I'm not sure entirely, I think in major respects this is a debate about value. Values are meaning interests that people have. And in particular, what a lot of people would say is, no, it's not. Well, it is, yes, but of course science doesn't have values. That's the thing about science. Science is value-free, whereas things like philosophy, things like religion, things like poetry and so on and so forth clearly do show value. Some values that we appreciate, other values that we don't appreciate. So that, for instance, when somebody puts, say, let us say, the Pope on various sorts of things, say, about homosexuality, a lot of people would say, well, clearly the man at this point is showing certain values. Some people appreciate these values, other people don't much care for these values, but they're values nevertheless. But the whole thing about science is that science is value-free, and a lot of people would cast the debate that way. I prefer, with other philosophers, or many other philosophers, not by no means all philosophers, to say, no, in fact, scientists are surely, even if science is objective, are surely, in some sense, committed to values of some sense. Namely, valuing truth, namely valuing getting one's ideas in correspondence with the way that things really are. And as many people have pointed out, Quine and others, in order to, as it were, maximise truth, it's pretty clear that scientists have methodologies, have techniques, and in particular subscribe to certain sorts of things which they, and value certain sorts of aspects of scientific thinking, which they think, if doesn't actually lead to full-blooded correspondence with reality, to full-blooded objectivity, gets us as close as one can hope to get in this vale of tears. And in particular, that scientists value certain things which we or have certain things which we know as epistemic values. Epistemic meaning knowledge-type values. The sorts of things that I've got in mind here, and again, as I say, I'm not being at all original here, is things like predictive accuracy, consistency with other theories, coherence within one's theory, consilience. Consilience is unificatory power. I mean, for instance, Darwin's Origin of Species, one of the great things about Darwin's Origin of Species, something of which Darwin himself was particularly proud, was the way in which it brought so many different parts of biology together under one subsuming hypothesis. And Darwin himself, on many occasions, said, well, I don't think a theory which is as powerful as this, doing all of this, could possibly be entirely false. In fact, Darwin thought it was entirely true. But certainly, something like that. And also, predictive fertility. The whole idea that a good scientific theory doesn't just tell you about what you've already got, but stimulates you to look into new areas where you get more successful predictions. Also, often suggested, although this is perhaps a more contentious one, is the whole notion that a true scientific theory has a certain elegance about it, a certain simplicity. And I'm sure we've all had experience, particularly when we were even just taking school science courses, where one's done a particular experiment or come up with a particular proof, and the supervisor or teacher has turned to you and said, yes, but it's not very elegant, you can do it such and such, and this is much better in some sort of sense. So, on the one hand, then, I see the objectivists as subscribing or pushing science as being something which manifests epistemic values. And I see the subjectivists as people who want to argue that, no, science in many respects, many crucial respects, and of course there are many variations of difference that people have on this, but that namely that science is in some sense ruled by non-epistemic, or what one might more popularly call cultural values, things like religious values, sexual values, political values, and so on and so forth. I mean, to take one example, in the 1970s, the big debate over sociobiology, for instance, the critics, people like Lewontin and Gould and others, said, well, of course, people like Wilson and others like that aren't really being governed by epistemic values, they're being governed by views about women and about races and so on and so forth. Now, what, of course, Lewontin and Co. were saying was that this is bad science and one should do it better, at least at that point. But what a lot of people would say is, well, yes, that wasn't very good science, but it wasn't very good science not because it's got non-epistemic values in it, but because it's got bad non-epistemic values in it. And a lot of people, feminists, Marxists, sociologists of science, people who work on rhetoric and that sort of thing, would say that all science has these non-epistemic values, in fact, is ruled by these. And so what we ought to try to do, people like Helen Longino and others would say, is what we ought to try to do is recognize the fact that one is ruled by non-epistemic values, and by God, or perhaps not by God, by humans, we ought to get the non-epistemic values right. A philosophical thesis, which I myself certainly have subscribed to and find very attractive, is that maybe one can find some sort of compromise, and Ernest McMullen, the historian and philosopher of science at Notre Dame, argues this. What he argues is that surely one has to recognize that immature science is in fact very strongly guided by non-epistemic values. I mean, early anthropology or something like that. But what one expects and what one hopes and what one indeed finds is that as science matures, as science gets better over time, that in fact the epistemic values expel the non-epistemic values. Not because scientists are necessarily nicer people, but because this is the way of science. So for instance, let us take say something like Hitler's racial biology or something like that. It wouldn't be held today, not because we abhor Nazis, although one hopes that we do, but simply because it's not consistent with what we know about modern genetics, for instance. So, in other words, things like consistency and coherence and that sort of thing have pushed those non-epistemic values out. And so, in fact, what one finds then, people like McMullen would argue, is that surely some sort of compromise, although I suspect the social constructivists would say it's not much of a compromise in our opinion, because in the end you're going to argue that the objectivists win. But some sort of compromise is that maybe science starts off fairly subjective but ends up reasonably objective. Now, what I've been trying to do over the last 10 years is take evolutionary theory as a case study. I'm I'm a naturalist in philosophy. I think that the way in which you try to solve philosophical problems is by case studies. In other words, go to contemporary science or go to the history of science with a hypothesis, say, about the way that science works, and let's see if it works or if it doesn't work. In other words, let's test our hypothesis against the evidence, against the empirical evidence. So that's what I mean by being a philosophical naturalist in this context. And what I've been trying to do, and in fact I've just recently published a book, of which I see that four copies are available just across the road in the window over there, Monad to Man, the Concept of Progress in Evolutionary Biology. And what I've tried to do is I've looked at progress, the idea of improvement, as a non-epistemic value, as a central non-epistemic value in evolutionary theory. And I think there's no question that when evolutionary theory was invented, if you like, or discovered, or however you want, what phrase you want to use, in the middle of the 18th century, this was the driving force of evolutionists. If you look at, say, somebody like Erasmus Darwin, for instance, Charles Darwin's grandfather, there's no question but that Erasmus Darwin didn't have much by way of empirical evidence. He had some, but not much. But what really turned him on was social industrial progress. He was a member of the Lunar Society. He was friends with people like Josiah Wedgwood and Matthew Bolton and all of these people. And he believed in progress. And certainly he saw evolution as a sort of a biological reflection of a social idea, which he then used to justify his social idea in a good old circular manner. And what I've been very interested in is the whole notion of progress as a non-epistemic value with respect to evolutionary theorizing, and basically what happens over the 250 years of its history. Now, I should say that I went into this study with a number of hypotheses. I mean, you know, Charles Darwin tells us that all observation must be for or against some hypothesis, that otherwise one might just as well go into a gravel pit and count stones. And so consequently, as a philosophical naturalist, I went into my study with a number of hypotheses. And in particular, what makes this, I mean, what one of the reasons why I chose this particular case study is that I think that there's a standard line. Namely, what I call hypothesis one here, namely that McMullen is correct, that yes, indeed, evolutionary theory was governed by non-epistemic values, cultural values in its birth, namely progress, but that today it isn't. That if you read John Maynard Smith on evolutionary theory, particularly if you read the professional stuff that he does, if you go to the Transactions of the Royal Society, places like that, you don't find progress there. Why is that? Because in the history of evolutionary theory, the epistemic virtues of certain moves have pushed the progress out. In particular, first of all, along came Darwin with natural selection, and natural selection basically says those that survive are those that survive. It's all very relativistic. I mean, is it the big one? Is it the small one? Well, it depends on the circumstances. So there really isn't any higher or lower, as Darwin corrected himself and said. And then along came Mendel. And of course, the basic building blocks of evolution that Mendel told us about, and namely the mutations, are random, not in the sense of being uncaused, but not occurring according to the need of possessors. I mean, if you know, it may be that we got a drought, so we'd all be better off if the next generation was smaller or more able to do without water or something. You can't rely on Mendelian mutations to give you that. And so what a lot of people say is, well, of course, evolutionary theory, particularly modern evolutionary theory, the kind of evolutionary theory that the Maynard Smiths of the world use, which is, in fact, built, I mean, it's a molecular version today, but built on the Darwin-Mendel insights, which had terrific epistemic virtues, their predictive fertility, unificatory power, and so on and so forth, have basically just pushed progress out to one side. So it's not that Maynard Smith may be personally an avid progressionist, but that's his personal beliefs. It's no part of his science because there's no place for it. His science has no place for it. So, as I say, I think a lot of people, I know a lot of people, have that as a standard view. Well, in fact, when I started off, I was more drawn to social constructivism than I am today. True confessions time, you know. And in fact, I thought that probably that was a load of bull. And in fact, I've discovered that indeed it was. That in fact, Darwin was an ardent progressionist before he discovered natural selection, while he discovered natural selection, and after he discovered natural selection. In fact, it's really interesting. If you read the successive editions of The Origin of Species, the first edition of The Origin is quite cagey on progress. I think everybody read The Origin and said, ah, progress rules okay, and Darwin said, of course it does. And if you look at the third edition of The Origin, which Darwin published in 1861, in fact, Darwin writes in a huge amount of progress. So Darwin certainly believed in progress. And certainly, I don't know what Mendel believed, but the Mendelians were progressionists. I mean, one of the most famous Mendelians, I mean, I could mention Maynard Smith's teacher, Halday, but let me mention Fisher, for instance, who is as great a synthesizer of Mendelian ideas and natural selection as anybody. Fisher was an ardent progressionist. He certainly believed that in the human species went into decline because the upper classes aren't breeding enough. But what he wanted was baby bonuses, family allowances, not for the poor, but for the rich, so that they would then have more offspring and so progress could continue on up. So, in fact, hypothesis one is just simply false. Hypothesis two, and you'll notice I've got 2A and 2B, what you might say is, well, really, Maynard Smith does believe in progress, and if we deconstruct what he writes, we will find that there's a hell of a lot of progress in what he writes, even in the transactions of the Royal Society. And in fact, to a certain extent, you might take some justification on some of the things that that Maynard Smith has been writing since he got tenure, since he retired, because there is quite a bit of progress there. But by and large, I think the simple fact of the matter is that progress certainly is nothing like as evident in contemporary evolutionary writings as it certainly isn't as it was in Erasmus Darwin or even in Charles Darwin. So hypothesis 2B, and this was the one I should say that I favoured when I went into my study, was that maybe, in fact, of course, today people are no longer so gung-ho about the social idea of progress. Surely, after the Holocaust, with pollution. I mean, I've spent, you know, half the day today on the M25, so you know exactly. I know exactly what I'm talking about. Who could believe in progress in this day and age? I mean, in an age of AIDS and nuclear holocaust and so on and so forth, who could possibly believe in progress? Certainly not, you know, contemporary intellectuals, you know, the folks who write in the New York Review of Books. Consequently, I thought, well, maybe everybody's into degeneration. So the reason why you don't find progress in contemporary evolutionary theory is they're all degenerationists, and if I look carefully, I will find degeneration. Well, in fact, I did find this in some people. I mean, certainly at the turn of the century, at the end of the century, the last century, people like E. Ray Lankester, for instance, were all pushing degeneration flat out. But to my great surprise, I did not find that contemporary evolutionists are, in fact, degenerationists. In fact, to my great surprise, I found that, by and large, evolutionists, like most scientists, are happy little progressionists. In fact, all you've got to do is get a couple of drinks into any scientist, and they'll start telling you about how they can do better than Tony Blair. I mean, scientists really believe in progress because I think they're an atypical group in society because they get progress in their work. I mean, whatever Kuhn said, you do get progress in your work. And I think that scientists sort of transfer this into their general thinking and then put it back into their evolution, or they would do if they did this sort of thing. So, in fact, I personally think that scientists tend to be progressionists and evolutionists in particular. In fact, I suspect there's a certain amount of self-selection, which certainly used to go on, that people were attracted to evolutionary theory and to work on it precisely because they did believe in progress. Certainly in the past this occurred. People like Theodosius Dobzhansky, if you look at his unpublished autobiography, for instance, he's quite explicit about this. And Ernst Mayr, for instance, is another case. I mean, still alive at 93 and going strong and determined to live one day longer than Sewall Wright. And absolutely believes in progress, believes that you get progress in science, and believes in progress in evolution, although you shouldn't talk about it too publicly. Hypothesis three was something else, and this is what I subscribe to today. And this brings me to sort of, as it were, the point of why I've given you this long sort of prolegomena and gets me right into my talk. What I found, in fact, was that progress is no longer a major item in evolutionary theory today. Not because evolutionists are not progressionists. I think many of them are. I don't say all of them are by any means, but I think many of them are. But because it's incompatible with the culture of science to have something which proudly proclaims non-epistemic values. In other words, a sort of what I call a meta-value, a value of science is that it be culturally value-free. And I found this was a consistent pattern through the history of evolutionary theory, not necessarily by evolutionists, until the 1930s and 1940s, when people like Meyer and Simpson and others set out very self-consciously to remove progress from their evolutionary biology, although they were to a person progressionists, because they weren't going to get grants, research students, places in universities, and all of those things, so long as they were seen as pushing foggy metaphysics, namely progress. Now, as I say, this sort of meta-value is something I don't know how far it goes back in the history of science generally, but it was brought home to me very vividly, in fact, by my study of Georges Cuvier, the great father of comparative anatomy at the beginning of the 19th century. Cuvier, as you may know, was a Protestant in what was becoming an increasingly conservative Catholic France, particularly after the Restoration. And Cuvier again and again and again said, look, it's okay to use me, to take advantage of me. Why? Because I'm a scientist, and science is unique in being objective, value-free. And in fact, you can find that Cuvier systematically attacks what he takes to be pseudosciences, which are clearly carrying their cultural values on their shoulder or publicly. And he does this because it's bringing down science, and in the end, it's going to bring down Georges Cuvier. So he takes after the natural philosopher, for instance. He takes after the phrenologists. And most importantly, he takes after Lamarck. And if you read Cuvier's critiques of Lamarck, again and again and again, Cuvier is saying, this is not the way we do science. This is not how physicists do science. We do not proclaim social values in science. Science is objective. Science is value-free. And evolution is not. Evolution is progress. So leave it out. And so what I'm saying is, I think that there's a very strong, what I call a meta-value, if you like, a value of the culture of science, that professional science ought to be non-epistemic, value-free. So what I think is that the conclusion I've come to about evolutionary theory, at least in this respect, is yes, evolutionary theory is something which is, if you like, non-epistemic value-free, culturally value-free in this respect. But it's because scientists are pushing it. In other words, they're pushing the objectivity of science for subjective reasons, if you like. You've got a sort of an interesting sort of, you know, it's like T.S. Eliot says in The Murder in the Cathedral, you know, the last temptation is the greatest reason to do the right thing for the wrong reason. And I think that this is particularly what has gone on in science. Now, my inclination is to think that the next generation, who don't know about this history, probably come into it and do it quite... I don't mean that people like Dobzhansky were deceitful. I think they were intentional. I think that probably today's scientists are doing this much more much less intentionally. In other words, they've absorbed the idea that science ought to be value-free, that progress is something which isn't necessarily part of their culture. And so today, I suspect that many evolutionary theorists are doing what they're doing for, you know, if you like, perfectly objective sorts of reasons. But what I've found is that the objectivity, at least at this level, was certainly, and I suspect even today to a certain extent, is pushed, as I say, because of the subjective reason that science ought to be value-free, and if science isn't value-free, or at least if evolutionary theory isn't seen to be value-free, then we'll lose even more grad students to molecular biology. Well, this has now led me to broaden my scope of interest, and what I've gone on to do now, and what I'm really interested in working on now is, are there other meta-values working on science, and in particular on evolutionary biology? Do I find that there are other values, as it were, as part of the culture of science, which in some sense are subjective, but which are, as it were, reflecting into the ways that scientists try to make science objective? And what I've done is I've looked at a number, and I am looking at a number of today's evolutionists to see whether this sort of thing is going on. I've been looking at the work of some of the great popular writers, people like Richard Dawkins and Stephen Jay Gould. I've also been looking at some of the people at the cutting edge. I mean, for instance, I've just come up from looking, talking to Jeff Parker up in Liverpool, for instance, and others. And I've also been looking at, as it were, some of the major figures in the field, the people, as it were, who are right at the pinnacle. Now, I wanted to look at John Maynard Smith, but the way that you do this kind of work is, to a certain extent, you do it by doing a citation search. You want to look at their work, you want to see how, you know, how influential are these people, how many people are citing them, and all of these sorts of things. And I've discovered that trying to do a citation research on somebody called John Smith is just simply impossible. So, you know, after I discovered that John Smith was not only working on evolutionary biology, but was also an anthropologist, was also a theoretical physicist, and so on, I said, well, give up John Smith. How about Richard Lewontin and Edward O. Wilson? And so what I've been looking at, because their names are far less common than John Smith, is I've been looking at Edward O. Wilson and Richard Lewontin and saying, are there meta-values, as it were, which are affecting the kind of science that they're putting out? And I think that there are. In particular, in the case of Lewontin, I'm putting these things forward as though, you know, without any backing. I do want to assure you that I've got lots of citations I can give you to back these claims. In the case of Lewontin, we all know notoriously that Lewontin is a Marxist. I'm inclined to think far more influential on Lewontin. I think the Marxism is a very thin veneer. I think that the real driving factor in Richard Lewontin's psyche is the fact that he's Jewish, that he was born in 1929 in New York City, and he grew up in the 30s and 40s when terrible things were happening to Jews in Europe. And I think that for all Jews of his generation, this led to great feelings of fear, to great feelings of relief, to great feelings of, dare one say, guilt, and many other things like that. And in fact, if you look at Lewontin's writings again and again, he says pretty much exactly that himself. Now, how does this affect the kind of science that Lewontin does? Well, it doesn't affect his science in a sort of a crude social constructivist sort of way. It doesn't mean that we find Dick Lewontin positing, you know, Jews are superior type genes. I mean, that really would be, you know, putting your cultural values right into your science. It's not ridiculous to suggest that somebody might do this. I mean, for instance, earlier than Lewontin, we find Henry Fairfield Osborne, the great paleontologist and director of the American Museum of Natural History, in the 1930s. Osborne, I should say, was a very upper-class American. He was friends of people like Teddy Roosevelt and others. Osborne put forward the idea of aristogenes, which were the sorts of genes that were possessed by people like himself, as opposed to all the Lower East Side immigrants who didn't have aristogenes. So, I mean, it's certainly not impossible to think that evolutionists might do something like this, but it's certainly not the case that you find Dick Lewontin positing Jews are superior genes. I did on one occasion find that Sewell Wright posited precisely that, but so, as I say, it's not impossible. But what I do find is that Lewontin, I think, imposes incredibly strict epistemic standards, particularly for claims about human beings. If you look at the kind of work that Lewontin does, and the kind of work that he finds acceptable, you will find that when it comes to claims about human beings, particularly human behavior, he doesn't want to say it's impossible. If you look systematically through his work, and for instance, he wrote a book for, I think, in Scientific American Press in 1981, where he says quite openly that he thinks that, what is it, Bergman's rule or whatever holds for humans, and that what is it, humans in farther north have, you know, less body area opposed to weight and that sort of thing than people down in the jungle. So, I mean, he's not against it absolutely. He's not ruling it out. But what you find, I think, is that he erects certain sorts of criteria, certain sorts of standards of what he's prepared to accept. And I think that you find that this, I believe, reflects itself into the kind of science, the kind of evolutionary biology that he produces. Now, an even more interesting case, and it really is, I find, particularly interesting, is the case of Edward O. Wilson, the great entomologist and sociobiologist. Now, it's pretty clear, anybody who knows Wilson, is that his southern background, it makes the man. I mean, that anybody who knows Wilson knows that the fact that he comes from Alabama is what Ed Wilson is. As much as the fact that Dick Lewontin is New York Jewish, the fact that Ed Wilson was not only a Southerner, but a Protestant Southerner, a born-again Christian at the age of 13, and then he went to the University of Alabama and fell amongst the heathens at 16 and lost one faith and took up Darwinism instead. So, in fact, therefore, I expect to find in Ed's work the non-epistemic, the cultural value of being a Southerner reflected. But what one does not find, again, in a crude sort of way, is Ed Wilson positing whites are superior type genes or something of that nature. In fact, if you read Wilson's work, you'll see, maybe he hasn't always been as careful as he ought to have been, but you'll see that, by and large, I think in all fairness, one has to say, Ed's pretty careful about this. And frankly, given the fact that he did come from a segregated college and so on and so forth, he really does, yeah, this sounds condescending, he does remarkably well. So you do not find in sociobiology the new synthesis Ed positing whites are superior genes and that sort of thing. What you do find in Wilson, and if you read his autobiography, that Naturalist, is an incredible veneration of the military. And Wilson stresses again and again and again that Southern society is one where a military career is considered the highest possible thing. And don't forget, Ed grows up in the 1940s when we're at war, where Southern heroes, and he says, I break down and weep every time I pass a monument, and I know, it's terrible, you know, you're walking along with Ed, and suddenly, boo, 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 Civil War monument. Oh, you know, it's impossible, he really does. And, of course, again, he feels particularly badly because he wasn't able to do any military service because he lost the eyesight, one eye, from a fishing accident and so on. What you don't find, however, I don't think, is Ed positing, well, military genes are good genes. I mean, for instance, Ed writes a lot about soldier ants, and I've gone through it very, very carefully. And if anybody was going to find it, I was going to find it. I do not find Ed Wilson saying soldier ants are soldiers, therefore they're good, and all those wimps who stay behind and tend the garden are a crowd of, you know, sort of faggoty ants or whatever you might want, you know, the kind that are loved by their mothers. No, he does not say anything. But what he does have, and he's quite explicit about this, is he has a terrific fondness for daring hypotheses. And his phrase is, though, a whiff of grapeshot. Again and again and again, if you look at the style of Wilson's writing, right from the 1950s, you know, when sociobiology wasn't even a dirty gleam in Bill Hamilton's eye, I mean, right from there, you find that there's a style and a willingness to accept certain hypotheses, to work in certain sorts of ways, and that's the attraction of sociobiology, is, by God, it is going to be, you know, rough and tough, and we're going to push out beyond the facts, if you like, because predictive fertility, unificatory power, push those sorts of things. So what I'm saying is, I do find that what I call those sorts of meta-values, I think are particularly important in the development of evolutionary biology. Now, whether you're going to say to me, oh yes, but that means, you know, at some point that's all going to get washed out. Well, maybe so. As I say, I'm a naturalist, I'm an empiricist. So if that is indeed the case, then you show me and I'll say I agree with you. And until you can show me, I don't agree with you. The final point I want to make is the following. Is, remember I said I see this as being a debate about values. Well, I think, I wasn't original in saying, because this is the way that many philosophers cast this objectivity-subjectivity debate, is I now think that that's just too narrow. I don't think it's simply a question of values, because it seems to me that the expulsion of cultural values does not necessarily imply the expulsion of culture. More and more, I've become convinced that scientists draw very deeply, very, very deeply on their culture, even when they're not necessarily valuing it or necessarily valuing it in their science. And in particular, evolutionary theory, I think, shows very strongly what I want to stress is the significance of the use of metaphors which are drawn from culture, which are used in the science to promote epistemic values, which are used in the science not simply to, as it were, give you a sort of a nice flowery bit of rhetoric or something like that, a good, you know, a nice feeling or some sort of literary thing or something like that, but which metaphors drawn from culture are used to promote epistemic values, even though it seems to me it is not necessarily followed that the scientists, in drawing these things from their culture, are necessarily valuing those elements of culture, or even if they do value them, are necessarily putting those values into the science. I mean, obviously we all know, you know, many of the metaphors we find in evolutionary biology: tree of life, natural selection, adaptive landscape, I think probably the most powerful metaphor of this century, ESSs, evolutionary stable strategies. One that I'm particularly interested in at the moment is, which Dawkins has made much of, the notion of an arms race. I should say that this is a particularly interesting metaphor. It goes back at least to the beginning of this century, to 1912, when Julian Huxley uses it in The Individual and the Animal Kingdom. And what I find is a particularly interesting symbiotic relationship between biological arms races and military arms races. That what happens is that Julian Huxley in 1912 draws on the military arms race of his day, which is between the battleships of England and Germany. And so he's talking in terms of things like armour, defence. Then you get into the 1920s and 1930s, where the arms race involves things like tanks and things like aeroplanes, where camouflage becomes very important. And you find people like Hugh Cott making much of arms races in terms of deception and these sorts of things. And then you come on to the 1960s and 1970s, as Richard has pointed out, where you get, for instance, arms races in the military world involve computers and that sort of thing. And so you tend to get discussions of arms races now in the biological world in terms of onboard computers and so on and so forth. Now, I don't think there's any question that Julian Huxley deeply valued aspects of the military culture. I mean, I think if you read what he says, but I don't see that it necessarily follows that one has to. And in particular, the study I'm looking at is the whole notion of the division of labour, which of course, as you know, goes back to the 18th century and Adam Smith. The division of labour, which when it's discussed by Erasmus Darwin, is clearly something that he highly values. The division of labour, when it's discussed by Charles Darwin, and I've got one of those computer things which enables me to type in division and labour, and I've discovered that Darwin uses this phrase, I mean, so many times, it's just amazing. But it's clear to me that Darwin deeply values the division of labour. But when you come on to somebody like Wilson, who's in fact written a great many papers on the leafcutter ants around 1980 on the division of labour, again, study it as I do, I don't find that Wilson thereby values the division of labour as something which is of value in our culture. In fact, it seems to be quite possible that one might say of the division of labour, well, surely Japanese techniques have shown us that humans are not robots, and the division of labour, where we all just do one specialised thing in a boring way, is not the most efficient thing to do with humans. It may work for ants, it does work for ants. It may work for robots, it does work for robots, but it doesn't work for humans. So what I want to say is, it seems to me that in cases like this, we're drawing deeply on the culture of society without necessarily valuing it. Now, of course, you might want to say, well, all metaphors are dispensable, and of course Aristotle said that, so it's a good tradition to go back to. But all I can say at this point, since I am running out of time, is that many philosophers, quite independently of any studies that Michael Ruse has been making, have been suggesting for a long time, people like Max Planck, that in fact metaphors seem to be a much more deeply rooted part of our thinking, and that so in fact you can't get rid of metaphors anything like as quickly as you might think. And what I want to argue is, why in God's name would we? I mean, surely, when Dawkins introduces an arms race, when Maynard Smith talks about an evolutionary stable strategy, when Wilson talks about a division of labour, they're using this to promote epistemic values, predictive fertility, above all, I would have said. And why, I mean, as it were, why castrate yourself for a philosophical thesis? Well, you know, Abelard might have a few things, but obviously it's not. So in the end, what I want to say is that my case study of evolutionary theory suggests to me that the objective-subjective dichotomy is not a clear cut, but that it's a particularly interesting question, because it shows you that the answers are a lot more complex than you might have thought when you went into it. And I certainly don't think that I've solved it. I don't think that I've solved it completely at all. But what I would want to suggest is that certainly through the metaphors of science, we have a great deal of culture brought into science. But more than this, I think that there are these things which I call meta-values, which are part of, as it were, of the culture of science, which in some sense are promoting and shaping the way that scientists think epistemically about their science. So ultimately, I want to say that science is both, certainly evolutionary theory is both objective and subjective. And all I can say to conclude is that only scientists and their tame philosophers could possibly think otherwise. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. Your talk has evoked so many anecdotes into me, I could go on for hours, but I won't. I'll just confine myself to the one of the happy afternoon I spent explaining to Dick Lewontin that all serious evolutionary biology is done by English country gentlemen who know about birds and butterflies, which didn't go down at all. However, we have plenty of time for questions. Can I ask you to do, if you want to ask a question, to do three things. Make it brief. Tell us at the beginning who you are and where you come from, and talk very loudly so that we can hear. And I'm going to leave it mainly to Michael to click.
One there, and
question.
Then I see what a couple over there.
My name is Richard Hall, member of the public. First of all, you mentioned, as it were, various ideas coming to what people produce. Have you examined how far things in which this subjective element comes, how it survives, and what people cite and what comes from the mainstream of science? And secondly, one of the elements of science is very important in crafting what you call guruism, which traces somebody who is alleged to have some sort of knowledge, and he, occasionally she, gives these ideas, and one evaluates it on the basis of, perhaps treats the words of a certain text, evaluates ideas on fidelity to it. And science is very different. For example, one doesn't talk about Einsteinians in the way that one can now say, in the way that, is that a relevant thing? Because it seems to me.
I haven't talked about national styles, and I think that some of the work that historians have done, people like Jonathan Harwood, certainly convinced me that national styles could be very important. And lead, say, geneticists to look at different issues. But I think Harwood and others would agree with me, we've got to go beyond sort of crude social constructivism and just simply say, well, it's all just, you know, fueled by culture. Because it's clear, as I said, that scientists do have this terrific imperative to be objective. And I mean, I think scientists take this, I think they take it very seriously. No.
Nicholas Maxwell, London School of Economics. Go back to what you were talking about right at the beginning, the influence of science, about non-epistemic values on science. It seems to be very important to distinguish two very different ways in which non-epistemic values can influence science. One, they can influence what you decide is true or false, or to accept or not to accept. Two, they can influence what you decide to study, what your choice of subject matter is. And why it's so important to make the distinction, whereas the first way is illegitimate, the second is inevitable and all-pervasive.
I think that's a very good point. You know, because the thing is, objectivists, I mean, if you look at, say, somebody like Ernest Nagel, he doesn't put it in these terms, but I mean, Nagel, for instance, who wants to argue very strongly that science is objective, says, of course, you know, there's a subjective element of what pragmatic issues of what we study. But then, of course, he ignores it. But I think you're right to draw attention to this, and perhaps to fault somebody like me for not at least having put a footnote in to cover myself on it. But I mean, I don't see what you're saying as being antithetical to what I'm saying. It's just another dimension to it. But of course, I mean, don't forget that scientists do, I mean, often say, well, of course, what turns us on is not the pragmatic, but because it's interesting or something along those lines. Man behind
me.
Yes?
Andy Wells, LSE. At the beginning of your talk, you were making a very clear distinction between epistemic and non-epistemic values. And then at the end, you seem to be making a distinction between epistemic values on one hand and cultural values on the other, which suggested somehow that epistemic values were not cultural values. Was I right in this?
Yeah, I think you were. I mean, I Sure, obviously, you might want to say scientists are part of culture or something like that. But I think I was using the word cultural in the sense of talking about religion, politics, that sort of thing, as opposed to, you know, when Maynard Smith turns to one of his students, say, and says, well, frankly, you know, it doesn't turn me on, it's not very elegant, or something like that. And I was excluding that, if you like, at that point from cultural. I mean, if you say, well, I feel uncomfortable about that, let's just use the word non-epistemic epistemic. Although, there is one point which I think is well taken, is and obviously at some level, I'm muddying the dichotomy, which of course is what so often happens. You know, you set out with a dichotomy which seems black and white, and at the end of the discussion, you clearly end up with grays. And I take it that my meta-values, in some sense, are gray. And I didn't go further than that. I mean, something like reductionism, for instance. I think that a lot of people would say reductionism is surely epistemic in some way. And yet, when somebody like Dick Lewington uses reductionism, and if you heard the tone of scorn that he's using, it's very clearly a non-epistemic value for him. Yes.
Yes, this moment, I'm very confused by what you're trying to say. Isn't part of the point that more than values, there is an ethic among communities of scientists because we do care about the truth, we do believe in it. And as a result of that, you know, whatever variety of cute American we may be, whether we're in Brooklyn or Hawking from Alabama or anything else, and anywhere else, we take on ourselves the responsibility of convincing the whole community of our colleagues, wherever they come from, we only believe we've done something of value if we actually manage to do that. Not because somehow we believe that everything goes back to culture or community, but because we think that that's the best bet to have actually done something which uncovered something that was true. And isn't it really, when everything is said and done, just that simple? I'm trying to be provocative.
I'm confused as to why you're confused. The point is, what I'm suggesting is, I mean, I take it that a crude social constructivist, I mean, because, you know, when you meet social constructivists, they always say, well, that's not my position, you know, that's, you know, or it's somebody else's, if all else fails, it's Bruno Latour's. Basically, what I'm saying is, I take it a crude constructivist would say something like, well, Wilson is a racist, he puts, you know, racial values in there, and that's built in. And what I'm suggesting is, I think that Wilson's Southern background does affect the kind of science that he produces, but I think it's more subtle than that. I mean, it's a simple connection once you see it, but you don't need to point it out.
Throughout history, various cultures have been successful, and others have been unsuccessful. And I put it to you that the successful cultures enable the genetic survival of the members. So there is a form of natural selection of actual cultures and the ethics of those cultures.
Well, that may be true, it's just not what I was talking about this afternoon. You may be right. I mean, I think there's a lot of debate about to what extent a culture survives because of natural selection and maybe because of a cultural selection or because of a Dawkinsian memes rather than genes or something like that. But I think that's an important issue. And I'm certainly not denying that perhaps the extent to which a science is success, a society is successful at using science may affect its success generally, although I'm not convinced that it necessarily means it's going to survive forever. But as I say, without wanting to put, I'm really not trying to put you down, you know, what I'm trying to do is deal with an issue within the society rather than society versus another society.
To look more to the right.
Okay. I thought you told me I was going to do all my own questions. Okay, age before beauty. I'm moving on.
Gentlemen there, I've been talking for quite a long
time. Max Hamilton, Newcastle. May I put it to you that one of the interesting things about it, the unique thing about evolution, I speak under correction, is that it's the only really great theory in science that has no connection with usable hardware. And as soon as you get collection with usable hardware, a very brutal kind of objectivity comes in. You remember that Kurchatov, the great Russian physicist, was once asked by Beria whether quantum theory was inconsistent with Marxist dialectic. And with an amazing combination of being at once diplomatic and truthful, he said, "I do not know, Connery, but you can't have the bomb without it."
I see. Well, that's a very interesting question, although it wasn't one I was talking about this afternoon. It's the tragedy at a certain level that evolutionists don't have usable hardware, because they can't get grants. You know, if they could only say, well, we cure cancer, the money would flow in. I mean, you are right at a certain level, although, I mean, it depends what you mean by usable hardware, because certainly, for instance, people like Lipshansky and his students in the 1950s convinced the Atomic Energy Commission that, in fact, studying fruit flies was the vital way of finding out whether or not atomic testing was affecting, you know, red-blooded Americans. So if that's usable hardware, there were some cases where they got, you know, something getting that way. But you're right, in other respects, it isn't. But whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is for my next talk.
Dare I come in on this one? I mean, look, if you go into hospital and you die of a drug-resistant staphylococcus, maybe you wouldn't have done if they'd taken a bit of notice of evolutionary biology. I mean, evolutionary biology has a lot of practical implications. It's just that doctors don't know any.
Susan Blackmore, Bristol. I was confused for a different reason than the man there. I was confused about what you were trying to do with your stories about Leontin and Wilson. And I would like to ask you two questions. What values are you applying to those stories for yourself? And what values do you expect us to apply? I mean, when you say, I have read this book loads of times, and I can assure you it's true, how are you expecting me to make up my mind whether to believe you about that or not?
Well, what I'm going to do is publish it with the references and invite you, if you don't agree, to go and look at the references, and please mention my name many times in your reputation. No, I mean, it's a good question. It's a good point. It's a very good point about the whole question of circularity. All I can say is, I think I'm sensitive to it. I'm not sure that I solve it. But the interesting thing is, the social constructivists are the ones who say, you know, modern science is all subjective, but we are the ones who do it. And the best I can do at this point is take them on their own terms, and that's what I try to do. But your point is one, I really do wake up in the middle of the night and sweat about it. Now, there's a woman right in the back.
That'll have to be the last question. Right,
it has to be the last question. Yeah. I don't think I do. I mean, I think I'd wait for somebody like you to challenge me and give me your definitions, and then I'll work from there. Basically what I'm trying to do is say, you know, well, what is science? Well, I look at, you know, who are the people who call themselves scientists? Who are the people who funded the scientists? I go, you know, I ask people, I say, well, what about Maynard Smith? What about him? He's an old codger, but, you know, is he a theologian? And somebody says, oh, no, he's a scientist. So that's basically what I do. Now, if somebody like you, I'm serious now, if somebody like you comes in and says, oh, yes, but I don't really think there's a distinction between, say, science and ideology on this thing, the best I can do at this point is say, well, you give me your definitions, and, you know, let's carry the debate on from there.
Okay, just before we go to tea, I have a small present to give you.
Tea is at five.
Oh,
God. Another talk.
Oh, sorry, there's another. We're not going to go to tea, we're going to have another talk. Are we ready? So we are. Thank you. But nevertheless, I'm going to give you a small present, Michael, from the Garden Centre. You're allowed to
open. I'm allowed to open.
Won't blow up.
The life of the cosmos. Well, jolly good. Thank you very much. I do appreciate that.
Even got a signature.
Oh, good. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Our next speaker is an anthropologist, Bob Martin. My own background is in zoology, and I have to confess, when I think of Bob Martin, I don't, in fact, think of the topic that he's going to talk to us about, which just shows that I'm out of date. I think either of somebody who is perhaps the world's leading expert on one of the most attractive groups of primates, namely the prosimians, which are really the most adorable animals. I know that's not one which you think about animals, but I do think it. But also, as an engineer, as a person who took a rather engineering attitude towards animals and thought about the following kind of problem. Supposing you're a mammal and you might be 8 ounces or you might weigh 3 tons, you know, what's the fuel consumption going to be? How much energy does it take to run a thing like that? That's a nice problem because it can be solved with much simpler physics than we're going to hear about after tea. And also, there's lots of nice data out there, so you can go and see whether the animals have actually read the engineering textbooks and are doing what they expect. I imagine that his lecture, which he's going to give us on maternal resources and brain evolution, has something to do with the fact that, for reasons I've never understood, brains are rather expensive things to carry around with you in terms of energy and nutrition and so on, and may therefore have some influence upon mothers who bear children. But I'm going to talk about, but it's all yours. Bob Martin.
Thank you very much, John. Before I start, I would like to thank Helena Cronin for inviting me to give this talk. I happen to be on sabbatical in England for 3 weeks, and the hypothesis I'm going to present to you has been somewhat beleaguered. I presented it in Nature in 1981, and some of my dearest colleagues have taken other views on it, and I'm grateful to have the opportunity to put my side of the story publicly. I'd also like to thank John for his introduction. He's one of my great heroes in biology, and I feel very privileged to be doing this with him in the chair. I'd like to start with the first slide. I'll be talking over the slides, so if we could have the first one. That explains it. Yeah. The first thing I want to say that I will only be talking about the size of the brain. I shall be saying very little about its internal construction. As John pointed out, my interest is in the energy relationships. And I must admit here that I'm very grateful to Michael Rees for his introduction. What I'm concerned with here is the scientific truth, and I would also like to admit to one non-epistemic value. I'd like to pay a personal tribute to Margaret Thatcher, because instead of asking what brains do, I asked how can we afford them. And one of the fundamental questions that's interested me and a lot of other people as an anthropologist is the fact that we have a brain 3 times bigger than a great apes of roughly the same body size. And lots of us have tried to come up with convincing explanations of why this should be. And most of the time it's phrased in terms of what we do with the brain. Now, first thing I want to do is to introduce this basic model of scaling to body size. Body size influences practically anything you'd like to think about in biology. And this is the basic model that I've been working to. There's a basic scaling formula. The maths don't matter too much, but the formula is that any character y that you're interested in will scale to body size x to the power alpha, and there'll be a constant before x. So y equals kx to the power alpha, and that's a curve. And in order to get straight lines, you simply take logarithms. So this is the basic approach. And if we take a series of species A, and I'll only be talking about cases today where we're scaling between species. You can also look at it within species, but that is not my concern. Each point here then is an average of species. That's the average for Y and the average for X. Today, most particularly, it will be Y will be brain size and X will be body size, but Y could be other things too. And one of the problems is that as you get bigger, your brain will tend to get bigger anyway. And I think the meaningful question we should ask is how big is your brain relative to the expectation for your body size? And so this scaling line here tells us what the general trend is. And the distance of a point above or below the line, which is its residual value, tells us by how much bigger this brain is than expected, and by how much smaller this brain is. So that's the basic approach. And the next thing is that quite often if you take another group of species B, you will find that they have the same scaling relationship. That is, the value alpha, which is now the slope of the line, is the same, but the intercept is different. The whole set of species has moved. Actually, this is just an extension of the residual value. Instead of one species moving, we have a whole group of species. But I call this a grade shift, and this is very important that you can have different grades in your data. It's a major problem. And talking of problems, this brings me to the four fundamental problems. In this, it's actually very difficult to get clear answers for various reasons. One of them is which statistical technique should we use for finding the best fit line. I won't go into that today, but I will say that according to the choice of line, you'll get different values for the scaling exponent, alpha value, and the intercept. That's one of the fundamental problems that we're really trying simultaneously to work out the slope of that line and the intercept, and they interact. The second point is that you can have grades, and I've just illustrated that. And if you simply ask your computer to fit a single line to the data, it will produce this line here, which I regard as an artifact. And the third point is, and this is a more recent development, is the recognition that species are related to one another in a phylogenetic tree, and therefore there's a potential problem of statistical independence. That these two species here may have similar values in both X and Y because of their shared common ancestry. And Joe Felsenstein wrote a paper in 1985 pointing out this problem and suggesting a possible solution, the contrast method. Joe is a very good statistician, very careful, and he said phylogenetic relatedness might bias your data. This has since degenerated into phylogenetic relationship will bias your data. And I'm not convinced that this is as big a problem as has been suggested. However, it is a problem and we must remember it. There's a fourth problem that I can't illustrate here, but it's a problem of moving from correlation to causation. What we have in one of these plots is the correlation between Y and X, and arguing from that to causation, that X actually causes Y or vice versa. In fact, both might be caused by something else that we're not looking at, and we will still get a good correlation. And so this problem of going from correlation to causation is something about which we have to worry. It's not a statistical problem really, it's more of a philosophical problem. I'd just like to briefly present what I think the biological model for these comparisons between species is, that within a group of species, there is a distribution here. There is no name in the literature for this. I suggested the name extruded normal distribution because it has a crest here, and moving away on either side of the line becomes less and less probable that you will find a point. And I would argue that this line represents some kind of biological optimum, and you can move away either way, but there is a cost to that. And that a grade shift is when there's been some realignment of several parameters, and say this parameter is moved. And so that's a grade shift. There'll be trade-offs with various other features, and looking at just one bivariate plot is not going to take us very far. We need to look at several parameters. Now I want to give you one very good illustration of the grade problem. And I'll be talking about gestation period, the time that the embryo and then the fetus develops within the mother. And this is a plot of about 400 gestation periods against body size for mammals. And most authors have fitted a single line to that distribution. However, if you've worked with mammals, and I would emphasize that biological knowledge of the organisms is essential. Just fitting lines to data without understanding the organism is not a good idea. And anybody who knows mammals well knows that there are two major groups. There are altricial mammals, which have a short gestation period and give birth to large numbers of poorly developed offspring. And there are precocial mammals that have long gestation periods like we do, and typically produce one infant, which is well developed at birth, the eyes and the ears, for example. And it would seem obvious on biological grounds that these should be two separate groups. So what we should do is go back to that graph, but now identify separately the altricials from the precocials. When we do, we get this distribution, and it's obvious that we have two separate distributions here. There's virtually no overlap. The difference is enormous. If your artificial male for any given body size, your gestation period is a quarter of what it is if you belong to this precocial group. So if your gestation period here is 120 days, in this group it'll be 30 days. So massive difference. And this is the clearest example of grade shifts that I know in mammals, but you get others which are more complex. Now the technique that Dirk Feltenstein suggests, and which Harvey and Pagel and other people have taken up, is the so-called contrast method to remove possible effects of prior genetic relationship. And the logic is very clear that if we have two species here, instead of taking the raw values, which might be biased, what we will do is take the difference between them. These are the contrast values, and instead of plotting the raw values, we plot the contrast values against one another. Now, I have reservations about this, and I will come back to this later. I think there is a trap involved in this when we're talking about scaling of the kind that I'm involved with. I should come back to this. However, there is an important logical point here. If you analyze the raw data, you will get one result. If you apply this contrast method, you may get the same result. You may get a different result. If you get a different result, the question is it because there was a bias in your data which you've now removed? Or is it because the contrast method has altered your data in some way? Now, I will try to show you that the latter can be the case. Now, the other point of going from causation, from correlation to causation, I would like to illustrate with this slide. I've been in Switzerland for 10 years, and you might think from this slide that we've rediscovered the mammoth in Switzerland, but when you put more light on the issue, you see this is not the case. And this is rather like finding a single correlation and arguing from it. What we should do is continually test it, try to make predictions, look at other correlations, and see whether there's something that stands up at the end of the day. Now to some practical examples. John mentioned metabolism, the energy turnover. We can measure this in a simple way. It's the oxygen consumption per unit time. And if we plot that for mammals, we find this relationship. Humans, by the way, here are almost directly on the line for these approximately 400 mammals. And the slope value here is about 3/4. And this is known as Kleiber's law. Now, an important thing here is the scatter around that line is quite limited. The maximum above the line is to have a basal metabolic rate about twice what you would expect, and here's about half. Now, in terms of other comparisons we can make, that's a very limited spread, and so it's a very tight relationship. A slide that seems to have got out of kilter. We'll take this one. If we do the same with brain weight against body weight, what we find here is that we have more scatter, and humans are right up here. So humans have an extreme value. They have a typical mammalian value for metabolism, but an extreme value for brain size. Compared to other mammals, we have a brain about 5 times as big as you would expect. That's the extreme above the line. Below the line, you can have a brain about 20% of what you would expect. So the scatter here is much greater than for metabolism. Now, I'm going to argue that there's a link between metabolism and brain size, but it obviously can't be a direct one. You can't explain our big brain simply on the basis of our metabolism, because our metabolism is normal, and yet we have a very big brain. So it has to be more subtle than that. Now, if we take a histogram of values, these are now the residual values, the distance above or below the line, the brain size. What we find is that primates are shifted to the right compared to all of the other mammal orders. Now, it's often said in literature that primates have bigger brains than other mammals. This isn't really true because there's quite a lot of overlap here. And these are humans here, and the next mammals to us are dolphins. can't say in any general way primates have bigger brains than other mammals, but there's intensity. The average value for relative brain size in primates is bigger than for other mammals. Now, a slide has got up already, but later on you'll see in histogram for basal metabolic rate, what you'll see is that primates are not shifted to the right for basal metabolic rate. So we cannot explain the larger brains of primates generally on the basis of a shift in metabolism. So for this reason, I would rule out any direct connection in the adult between basal metabolism and brain size. Now, a further point here is that I said I wouldn't say too much about the internal workings of the brain. I would just say this, that if we look at the take here, brain size as our X, and individual parts of the brain, such as the neocortex and the hippocampus and so on, across a number of orders of mammals, the scaling is fairly predictable. So this means there's a basic pattern to the mammalian brain, and if you know its size, you can predict to about 90% accuracy what the size of the individual parts are going to be. However, there is scattering, there are great differences, and in primates, for example, the higher primates have a bigger neocortex for any brain size than the lower primates do. But by and large, brains are very predictable in their composition. This is the graph to which I allude. This is the residual set for basal metabolic rate. And you'll see primates here sit on the average for mammals. There's no shift to the right for primates. So primates are shifted to the right for their relative brain size. They fit other mammals for their relative basal metabolic rate. Now, another thing that you need to know as part of this story is that the brain has increased in size in all lineages of mammals, as far as I can see. I've never seen an exception to this. If you take a living primate or another living mammal and you find a fossil relative, the fossil relative will always have a smaller brain than the modern form. So there's a general tendency for brains to get bigger throughout the mammals. This is an example. John mentioned that I had a particular affection for prosimians, and here are three of them from Madagascar, and these are modern lemurs, and this is a fossil relative, 50 million years old. And 50 million years ago, the skull was very similar in many features, but the brain is less than half the size. So brain size has increased. And if we look at primates generally, you find this along every lineage. So what's unusual about humans is that the rate of increase of brain size was particularly fast. But brain size increase has been a general tendency throughout mammals. Now, the next thing I want to consider are possible suggestions to why the brain should get bigger. Now, there was in the 70s a particular attempt to relate relative brain size to behavior, and there were a number of suggestions that fruit-eating primates had bigger brains than leaf-eating primates. And the reason for this is that fruit-eating primates need to find their food resources, whereas leaf-eating primates find their food relatively easily. And so you need a bigger onboard computer if you're a fruit-eating primate than if you're a leaf-eating primate. So this is asking the question, why do primates need bigger brains? Now, I believed this for about 6 weeks until this paper came out by Eisenberg and Wilson, and what they showed is that in bats, fruit-eating bats have brains twice as big as insect-eating bats. It's another example of a grade shift. The insect-eating bats have a line of the same slope, and the fruit-eating bats have shifted upwards, doubled their brain size relative to the insect-eating bats. Now, in that paper, exactly the same argument was used, which is that if you eat fruit as a bat, you need a large onboard computer to find your fruit, but if you do this, you don't. And I didn't see that it's necessarily easier to hunt insects on the wing using sonar, that is to find fruits. And fish-eating bats that dive bomb fish and scoop them out to the surface of the lake are intermediate. They have intermediate-sized brains. And so I began to suspect that there was no really direct connection in ecology. And there is another solution. The solution is that McNabb has shown that insect-eating bats have much lower basal metabolic rate. blacks and the fruit-eating blacks. And so I suspect that there was a connection with metabolism. And it couldn't be a direct one because I said there's a lot more scatter in brain size than there is in relative metabolic rates. So the explanation has to be somewhat more complex. But basically the argument is that if you've got brain size against body size, against base metabolic rate, we have what is called an isometric relationship, the slope is one. There's direct proportionality between brain size and basal metabolic rate. But of course there's also scatter, as you can see, so you have to explain the relationship and the scatter at the same time. And the scaling experiment that I reported in my original paper, brain size was 8.7 by 3/4, just like basal metabolic rate. So my suggestion was that there is an indirect relationship between these two. One of the lines of argument is the following. If we take babies at birth for mammals, and we plot the size of the brain at birth against the size of the body at birth, primates form a distinct grade relative to other mammals. So at birth, for any given body size, a primate has a brain roughly twice as big. So this shift in average brain size in primates is probably due to a difference in development. It was this finding, which was actually made by George Sacher in the 60s, which pointed me in the direction of development as being a crucial factor here. And so I developed this hypothesis, the maternal energy hypothesis, and it's basically as follows, that here we have maternal body size, and maternal energy resources through the placenta and through the milk glands provide the resources with which the fetal brain and then the infant brain develops. And by the time of weaning, much of brain growth is complete. Brains are unusual organs in that they reach virtually their adult size very early in development, and it's not long after the time of weaning. So if we're looking at the development of the brain, really it's maternal resources that matter here. So what I'm arguing is that it's the mother's metabolism through gestation and lactation that contributes to adult brain size. So the correlation that we have is not between my brain size and my body size, but between my brain size and my mother's body size, and her metabolism in particular. But there are intervening variables here. You can vary the gestation period, you can vary the lactation period, and there are other things that you could vary here. And this could explain why you get the scatter. You get the same overall scaling relationship, but you get individual shifts in individual species. So we can explain here why we get greater scatter in brain size relative to metabolism. Now, Harvey and Pagel in 1991 argued on the basis of two previous papers that this hypothesis was wrong and should be forgotten about. And in fact, it suggested that if my prediction had held, the next step would have been to try to model this. Now, the two main criticisms in those two earlier papers were, first of all, that you have to have an increase in basal metabolic rate and gestation period. Now, my model doesn't require that at all. You can have an increase in maternal metabolism, or an increase in gestation period, or indeed an increase in lactation period. All of these things can lead to bigger brains, but you don't have to have them together. And in fact, I tend to believe these are alternative strategies, that if you produce a large brain infant, it is either by higher metabolism or by longer gestation period, but rarely both together. And I'll try to show you if this is the case. Now, I think that argument simply was wrong. I've never argued that you have to increase metabolism and gestation period. The second argument was much more important, which is that I had not mentioned litter size. And so the argument was that I've only considered a single infant here, and if you have multiple litters, you can have a problem. Now, this again is an example of arguing at different levels. If we're looking at the overall investment of a mother over her lifetime, then litter size is important. My argument is that the physiological simplistic way of looking at this is like light bulbs with an electricity source. The mother's the electricity source. And if you plug a fetus into this, or if you plug two in, you can either plug them in series, in which case both will glow half as brightly, or you can plug them in parallel, in which case one fetus will be just the same as one in a pair. And gestation seems to be more like plugging light bulbs in parallel. That is, that if you add fetuses to it, they simply draw what they need from the mother over that period, depending on the gestation period and the mother's metabolic level. So I do not believe that litter size has to be a problem here, but there is a way around this, simply to take precocial mammals that usually only have one infant anyway and see whether things work out, at least with that. Now the other problem which has occupied me greatly is this question of contrast analysis. And Paul Harvey and Mark Cagle did a contrast analysis for basal metabolic rate. So these are now the differences between species according to the tree. And this is basal metabolic rate here against body weight, and you get the same three-quarter slope. So that's fine. You get a slope of three-quarters with the raw data, do the contrast analysis, and you still have the three-quarter slope. But when you do this with brain, you get a different slope. Instead of three-quarters as you get with the raw data, you get a slope of about 8.67 or two-thirds instead of three-quarters. As I said, the question here is, does this mean there was a bias in the original data which has now been removed? Or does it mean that contrast has done something strange to my data? Now, Harvey originally published this paper in Nature, this figure in a paper in Nature, in which he used averages for orders. And these were developed up through the taxonomic level, so it took into account that you had many species in one genus, and so it was just weighted all the way up. So these are overall graded averages for each orbit. And when you do that, the slope of the line is three-quarters. But this is without contrast. Now, I'd like to explain to you quickly one of the primary reasons why I think contrast may not do what we expect of. I've done here is a quick calculation on the back of an envelope. Here we have two species, and we have species 1 and 2. The formula for species 1 is log y1 equals alpha, log x1 plus log k. And the second species is the same set as y2 and x2. So we have different body sizes and different values for brain. And when we subtract them, what we get is the difference, the contrast in y is the same as alpha times the contrast in x. And if you plot that, then you should get a very nice line with a slope alpha, and log k cancels out, so there's no intercept. There's also a technical reason that I won't go into as to why the intercept should be zero when you plot these contrast values. Now, I've always believed that it's probably best to look at fronts of envelopes because they're more informative. And if you look at the front of this envelope, what we see is that if we have grade shifts, the k values here are different, so we have log k1 and log k2. There's also an error term here, which will differ. And the error term can be all kinds of things, from measurement error to misquoting the source of data, all kinds of things running together. And this is biological deviation from expectation. Statistically, these two things are not distinguished. That's all error as far as a statistical model is concerned. Now, if we subtract them, we don't get the contrast values, but we have these residual terms here, which are due to the grade shift and differences in error. Now, the next problem is that if your two species are very closely related together, body size will be very similar, as will brain size. So these two contrast values will be very small. So what you do by taking contrast values is emphasize the effect of the error term. Ideally, if you've got a beautiful set of data with lots of closely related species, you should theoretically end up with a plot of aerocones against aerocones. I don't think this is going to get us very far in terms of interpreting phylogenetic relationships. Now, that's the theory, and I tested it, and I hope to show you that this is what actually happens. What we can do is take a phylogeny for 14 mammals here and look at the contrast values. First thing I tried was to take average values for each mammal order, and when you do that, you get a slope of about 3/4. So each point here is the contrast for an average value for an order. But it could be thought that perhaps by averaging orders I have introduced a bias. So what I did then was to take one species at random from each order, so I have single species in the comparison, and then compare the results. The next step, instead of taking one species per order, we take two species per order. And to go back to this equation, what that will mean is that these contrast values will be very small, and so we'll have some of our contrast values with a large error term. So if I take two species per order instead of one, which has doubled my sample size, I should get a less efficient result. Here are the results of those analysis with 10 runs at random for each. This is the slope of the raw values, we've averaged it up to almost exactly 3/4. If I do an intercept through the origin, I get 3/4 for the contrast values as well. So for single species from those 14 orders, the same result emerges after contrast as before. If I take two species per order, the intercept through the zero shifts to the left as a reduction, and the average value is 0.69. So by taking a lot of closely related species, you can in fact get a result which I would regard as misleading. Now if we go back to these equations, there are two other ways to test this. We can alter the residual values, or we can increase the error artificially. So we take actual data, and you can double the residual values, or you can add random error. And interestingly, with the raw plot, provided this is random, the answer turns out roughly the same. So you get a slope of 3/4 still when you've added error into these terms. But when you do the contrast analysis, it has a massive effect as predicted, because the error term is overemphasized. So I believe I've shown that this approach can lead to misleading results when we're concerned with such fine error state. So I would argue that my model is still intact. There is isometry between base and metabolic rate and brain size, even after contrast analysis, and that the two objections that were raised really do not invalidate the model. Now, a second development that's taken place is the hypothesis put forward by Ello and Wheeler, which is called the expensive tissue hypothesis. And basically, the argument is very beguiling, is that if you have a big brain, then you cannot afford to have a big gut. Or vice versa, you can have a big gut, you cannot afford to have a big brain. And so that the reason we have such big brains is because we have relatively small guts. Now it's obvious at an individual level that the cost of each organ must add up to the total cost of the body. But the question is, has it actually been a trade-off between these two organs in evolution which has affected the evolution of brain size? And unfortunately, Ido and Wheeler started off their paper by saying these conclusions derived from general observation that there is no significant correlation between relative base and metabolic rate and relative brain size in humans and other encephalized mammals. So this was a direct exclusion of the maternal energy hypothesis. And the reason for this is a paper by McNabb and Eisenberg, in which they did an analysis which I regard as absolutely correct. They took relative brain size against relative metabolic rate, and when they did the analysis, they found it wasn't quite significant. P-value is 0.08. Now, it's not really a major problem anyway, because I'm not arguing a direct connection between these two variables. I've said, gestation period and other things into being here. But the magic value of peak was 8.85, was exceeded. However, there's a statistical mistake in this analysis, which is as follows. These are not the logarithmic residual values, but they are the quotient values, the antilogs. And the antilogs are not normally distributed. The reason for this very easily, the logarithmic values are normally distributed around the line. If you convert them back to real numbers, the points below the line are squeezed together, those above the line drawn out. So these are no longer normal distribution. And so what you should do is to do this statistical test on the logarithmic values, and the p-value is 0.84. So it's below the magic level. So in fact, there is a significant correlation between the residuals, and on a my own data set, I confirmed this with an even better p-value. Now, one of the problems that we've back to is so there is a correlation here. If there were no correlation between phase of metabolic rate and brain size, it would also invalidate the expensive tissue hypothesis we've got, because other things being equal, you would expect if the metabolic rate were higher, you could afford to have a bigger brain. And so you have the same expectation both with my hypothesis and with the expensive tissue hypothesis. However, you can make a couple of predictions to test from the expensive tissue hypothesis. One of them is to go back to those shifts that I mentioned in relative brain size. Here we have, for a sample of mammals, where we've got gods and brains. Here are the primates, and here are the non-primates. Primates are shifted to the right. On average, they have bigger brains than the non-primates. That's humans, by the way. And that's a dolphin. If we do the same with gods, the prediction should be if there's a trade-off between brains and gods, primates should have smaller guts than other mammals. And so here's the plot of relative gut size units for primates and non-primates. In fact, primates have slightly bigger guts than other mammals, but it's not a significant difference. They certainly don't have smaller guts to trade off against the big brains. So this doesn't apply to primates generally. And if we go back to the bats, the insectivorous bats, insectivores have even smaller guts than frugivores. So in insectivores, I predicted in bats that they should have small guts and small brains. And Kate Jones, who's doing a PhD at Roehampton, has tested this, including contrast analysis, and has shown there's a positive relationship in bats. The bigger your brain, the bigger your gut. So there's no trade-off in bats. And finally, I've been in Cambridge for the last 2.5 weeks. Wednesday, David Chivers, his data collected with Marcel Thaddy on the basis for these analyses. And if you exclude humans, which are an unusual case, it could be in humans that we do have a trade-off between our brains and our guts, but for non-human primates, there is no significant correlation between relative brain size and relative gut size. So this alternative hypothesis, in my view, doesn't stand up to examination. Now, I'd just like to mention a few further tests of my own hypothesis that it's maternal investment, direct physiological investment, that influences the size of the brain. What we can do is plot brain residuals against basal metabolic residuals. Same analysis as McNabb and Eisenberg did with my data, I get a correlation, which is significant. However, according to my hypothesis, gestation should also affect this. And so what we can do is look at brain residuals against the added residuals for basal metabolic rate and gestation. As I've said, you can have a bigger brain either because the gestation period is longer or because the basal metabolic rate is higher, or perhaps both together, not necessarily. But only my hypothesis would predict that this should improve the relationship, and it does. The correlation curve is much better when you add in gestation to basal metabolic rate. Both have an effect, and explain quite a lot of the variance. There's still a lot of unexplained variance, and my prediction is that when we take lactation period into account, this will get even better. An alternative alternative way to do this is partial correlation analysis, which is to ask what is the difference if we remove the effect. So we can ask what is the correlation between gestation and brain when we remove the effect of body weight and basal metabolic rate. In a nutshell, the answer is that basal metabolic rate, gestation period, and body weight contribute roughly in equal amounts to brain weight. But gestation period and brain metabolic rate show a negative correlation. They're positively correlated with the raw data, but when you exclude the effects of these two variables, it becomes negative, which is what I'm arguing, that you can either increase your basal metabolic rate or your gestation period, but you wouldn't normally do both. I'll just skip ahead. I think I should finish quickly. One of the paradoxes of this is that if you argue the maternal energy hypothesis, you still haven't explained why brains get bigger. You've explained how they can get bigger, but not why. And so I've been naturally worried about this problem. And the other thing is that I've said that as species size gets bigger, brain size gets bigger. But it seems to be obvious that if you're bigger and have a bigger brain, presumably you have more nerve cells and should be able to do more things with it. There's a bit of a paradox there, which is forgotten when we take out the influence of body size. But recently, Boitis has published this model, which I think may help to explain things. He says that brain evolution is actually a two-phase process. There's passive growth. If body size gets bigger, brain size tends to get bigger. And there's active growth, which is selection acting on particular behavior patterns. And one correlation that seems to survive a lot of tests on it is social organization, the size of the social group. And this seems to show a definite correlation with neocortex size. And so we can explain the maternal hypothesis here as contributing to passive brain size increase with body size and the active brain due to selection. Of course, if you have selection for a bigger neocortex for social organization, it will then translate into bigger brain. So these two things will come together. But that, to me, provides a possible resolution to the paradox. So I just want to finish off with one finding which I think fits the maternal energy hypothesis quite well and raises some exciting possibilities. But I'd like to thank Barry Kavan for putting me onto this during a previous visit to Cambridge. And it's as follows. I always thought that we have one set of chromosomes in our cells from father's side and one set from the mother's side. And I always thought that these two sets were essentially equivalent, although the alleles would differ. But this isn't quite the case. There are an estimated 200 genes that operate during development in which either the maternal copy or the paternal copy has been switched off. And this is known as genomic imprinting. There seems to be a reversible process, at least in some cases, which imprints a gene during development. And since some genes are switched off by the mother and some by the father, balance is required. And it's very difficult to experiment on this because if you can experiment with an embryo that only has paternal chromosomes or only has maternal chromosomes, they don't get very far in development. But Barry and his colleagues have a technique where you have a chimera in mice where 50% of the cells are normal and 50% have only paternal or only maternal chromosomes. So we can see what the effect is. It's a bit difficult to think about this because if a gene is maternally imprinted, it means the mother switched it off. If a gene is paternally imprinted, the father has switched it off. So we're looking at genes that are left active in one sense. And what we find is in mice, halfway through pregnancy approximately, if you've got 50% normal cells and 50% of your cells only with paternal chromosomes, have a small brain and a large body, and if you have 50% of your cells normal and 50% with only maternal chromosomes, you have a big brain in a relatively small body. So there's evidence here that genes that are not switched off by the mother are actively favoring brain development. And the punchline to this, these analyses I'm still completing, but I went back as a result of Barry's paper, because he divides the brain into the executive brain and the emotional brain, and the maternal effect is particularly obvious in the executive brain, which is essentially the neocortex. And when I went back and we did my correlation separating the brain, what I found is that the correlation is between basal metabolic rate and the neocortex. When you exclude that, there's very little correlation with the rest of the brain. I think this all ties in together. What it means, I don't exactly know. Perhaps in a couple of years I can come back. But one can interpret this in terms of Haig's idea of maternal-paternal conflict, that the father's benefit, or the father's best interest, is served in one way, and the mother's best interest in another way. For some reason, mothers seem to be investing more in brain development, fathers more in body development, but I can't explain why that is. Thank you very much.
And remind you, speak up and tell us who you are.
I'm Dr. Guinness from Middlesex. If I've understood your lecture correctly, I think that's not the answer. Mathematically speaking, your arguments are based on the function relation of y equals kx to the alpha when you do the Muslim. What are the grounds upon which that particular form is preferred over others?
The formula.
Why that particular form, why that function rather than that particular?
I must admit it's essentially traditional. It goes back to Huxley's time. Julian Huxley wrote quite a bit about idolatry, and so the use of that form has been traditional. People have suggested other formulae, and in some cases you can get a slightly better fit, but it does describe these relationships very well, and it has the advantage of simplicity in analysis, but there are possible other solutions. That hasn't really been tried very much. Most of the people working in this field have been using that elementary formula, and so it's essentially tradition and it's simple.
There's no real scientific theory behind it then?
Oh yes, sorry. Okay.
Is there a line of argument of which is the last line?
No, sorry, I thought you were arguing about curve fitting, but if there is
no,
a good argument.
Yes, I've used that too.
In response to the other question, Huxley himself argued that this comes down to growth programs, and I firmly believe this, that everything in our body grows at a particular rate, and you can actually derive that allometric formula within a species from relative growth rate. So if you integrate relative growth rates of, say, the brain and the heart, you can derive the allometric relationship between them. The leap of faith is to say the same formula can then apply between species. But, you know, one can imagine why it should, because within a species we have an average end product of these growth processes, and therefore the same formula might work between species, but that's shakier. I think within species, Huxley's argument is.
Okay, I'm Leslie Ayala from University College, and I'm the author of Brains and Nuts. And I think that Bob isn't being quite fair in relation to the hypothesis, because what the expensive tissue hypothesis actually states is that you can't look at brain size in isolation, that you have to look at it in the context of metabolic rate and all of the other expensive organs. And there's a deal. It's not necessarily only a payoff between gut size and brain size. And it just happens in humans that our guts are exactly as small as we need to balance the size of the brain. And you can work through this. Also, on the basis of my data in primates, there is a highly significant correlation between relative brain size and relative gut size. So we have a little bit of problem in data there. But in terms of the bad example, I find this very interesting, but I also find it quite interesting that your food-eating bats have very large guts. They also have very large brains, but they have unusually high basal metabolic rates. So they have a metabolism to pay for both. And the whole point is that we have to balance it off. And in relation to exactly the size of Kent. It's exactly the size of New England that would be predicted for an average mammal of our body weight. But our brains are about 800 grams bigger, our guts are 800 grams smaller, and it balances out on basal metabolism. Now, I think that Bob and I are actually looking at two different sides of the story that we have to put together. Bob's talking about how we can afford to grow a large brain. I'm talking about how we can afford to maintain that brain as an adult. And I don't think that we can understand actually why we have large brains, or why any other animals have small brains and relatively large brains, unless we understand those sides of the story.
Thanks, Leslie. I mean, I'm sorry if you felt I was being unfair. I tried to, well, I was putting my side of the story, which is fair enough. One correction I would make is that bats do, fruit bats do not have unusually high basal metabolic rates. They have the mammalian average. It's the insect-eating bats that have unusually low metabolic rates. And so I don't think that argument applies. The fact remains that big guts in bats go with big brains and not vice versa, as a generalized form of this hypothesis would suggest. And I'd like to ask you, in fact, whether you now accept that at the beginning of your paper where you said that the returned energy hypothesis was wrong, because it's important to establish that. I fully agree we can have things operating at different levels. I'm talking about development, this is talking about trade-off in the adult. They needn't necessarily be in conflict with one another.
Well, I actually in that paper didn't say the maternal energy hypothesis was wrong. I said there was no direct one-to-one relationship between metabolism and brain size. And, you know, I can't take it that there is a statistical problem, but your correlation coefficient is only not 0.15, and that explains less than 4% of the variation. And I think that we have to look at something else to explain the other 96%. So I'm sure that we'll ultimately meet on this, and hopefully we'll understand a lot more about the causes of increase or decrease in brain size.
Christopher Badcock, LSE. Of course, as you probably know, there is a possible explanation for the mystery you mentioned at the end, why the mother's genes should build the neocortex and why the father should build the limbic or emotional brain. And that's in terms of what some of us are calling a Hague's rule. And Hague's rule says that the self-interest of maternal and paternal genes in mammals is not the same. And the reason is that in a mammal, any gene in the mother has a 50% chance of being in any of her offspring, and therefore has a 50% vested interest in her continued reproductive future. But any paternally active gene has no necessary reason ever being in that particular mammalian mother again. So it has a self-interest in demanding more of her resources. Now, the limbic brain, and in particular structures like the hypothalamus, are particularly concerned with impulse and emotional demand management. And the argument would be that the reason why mothers grow the largest possible neocortical brains they can in mammals is that one of the principal functions of the neocortex is to inhibit, repress, and generally control the demands for gratification and resources arising from the limbic brain. And this raises the astonishing possibility, and this goes back to the point Michael Roos mentioned in his lecture, that the ultimate explanation of the still unsolved mystery of mammalian brain growth and human brain growth in particular, might be an arms race between maternal and paternal genes for control of development and behavior, with the mother wanting an ever larger neocortical brain and the father wanting an ever more demanding limbic one.
Thank you very much. I'll have to go away and think about that, but it sounds very reasonable at first.
Yeah. One question.
Susan Blackmore, Bristol. I love that idea because it's extreme enough and bizarre enough, if you like. I got the impression that you two here are trying to take this, what seems a real mystery, there's huge human brains and huge dolphin brains, and make it not so surprising. I'm very interested in another approach which comes straight out of Richard Dawkins' idea of memes, which is the possibility that why there's this mysterious huge brain in these species is because you have a second replicator running, which is running on the demand of brain space. It's a replicator fighting it out for brain space, and therefore demanding more brain space, and therefore getting it. What memes depend on is imitation, and as far as we know, the only species which are seriously capable of widespread imitation are humans and dolphins. I wonder if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, I don't see any conflict between what you're saying and what I'm saying. I think what your argument would boil down to is a general selection pressure for all mammals to increase their brain size, which is one of the principles that I mentioned. And then if you find species that have particularly big brains, you can explain it in terms of the particular development of memes. But you're still left with the question, why humans and dolphins? Why didn't this happen in other mammals?
Can I just answer that?
Very briefly, and that'll have to be then, yeah, okay.
Why? Because it's right outside natural selection operating on genetic selection. The argument is, from dolphins, there is actually a second replicator. It's not the genetic fitness that's important, it's the mimetic fitness. And that's because only those species can run memes, because they're the only ones capable of imitation, and that's what makes it quite different. That would be the argument.
Richard wants to get in since we've talked. Is that right? That was worrying me too, but I thought perhaps we should argue about it over tea.
Do you want me to answer or do you want me to leave it?
One or two sentences, and if we don't clear it, we'll clear it up over tea. But go ahead.
I suggest that you have to start with useful memes, so that as memes develop in any species, they change the environment in which selection is operating, so that the organisms, the individuals within the species who are good at picking up those memes, have a selective advantage. And they are going to be the ones with bigger brains because imitation is extremely expensive in brain space. That provides the driving force for bigger brains, but it's only happening because there is direct meme competition, quite in addition to gene-gene competition.
I think we have to break here for tea. But before we do so, let me thank Bob Martin again and hand over your presence. And can I ask you to try and get back here pretty promptly at whenever?
Yes.
Half past five, and there are stewards who will show you the way to tea. As I said before the first of our lectures this afternoon, I thought that Darwin would not be altogether surprised to find that philosophers were interested in what he'd had to say. I think he would be a little puzzled, or would have been a little puzzled, to be told that cosmologists would be interested in what he had to say, if only because he hadn't the remotest idea, I guess, what a cosmologist was. However, it has been a problem that biologists have sort of worried about as to why the world out there appears to be sort of just right for us to live in. We've tended to reply, oh, well, of course, we have evolved to adapt to the world. The world has not evolved to adapt to us. But I think there have been features of the world that have puzzled us a little about their extraordinary suitability. And I'm delighted that Lee Smolin is going to talk to us about this actually really rather hard question. Why is the universe hospitable to the life? He's promised that the quantum gravity won't actually be more than the first three quarters of an hour of the talk, and after that, you'll be able to understand. Lee, it's all yours.
Well, I'm very glad to be here. I'd like to thank Helena for the invitation. I know it's unusual, perhaps, to have somebody who does theoretical physics and cosmology talking about Darwinism, but I hope by the end of the talk, it will be clear. I'd like to start with an image for which I've turned down the lights, and I hope all this technology works. This is a painting by the Mexican surrealist Remedios Varo from about 1960. She was a classmate of Salvador Dali and not enough known. This is called The Creation of the Birds. Does it need to be focused? It looks all right to me. And in it we can see a couple of things. First, that the question of what is life and why is there life in the universe is of wide interest, and indeed there are many artists and writers and philosophers who have wondered about this. And second, we see from her depiction some beautiful things about the question. First, how is she making a bird? She's making a bird first from starlight coming there, which is focusing through a prism. Then there is harmony, the music there. And of course, she who is making the bird is herself a bird, although she's also the painter. And we see from this, of course, the great principle which Darwin taught us, and so many of his followers have taught us so well, which is that life makes life. And to me, the most wonderful thing that we've learned from biology is the possibility that all of the beauty and all of the variety, and to use an overused word, complexity of the natural world is something that arose not by some forms which were externally imposed on a system, but arose from the system itself over time, from some simple bath of chemicals, we believe, although the problem of how life got started is certainly unsolved, over time to become more and more highly organized. And essentially, what I want to suggest in this talk is that in two ways, this question of how is life in the universe, how is the universe hospitable to living things, tells us something about the future directions of physics and cosmology. First, because we have to answer the question that John Maynard Smith said so well, why is it, in fact, that as I'll describe a little bit later, in fact, it does seem that the universe is enormously well-suited for life. And second, can we steal from the biologists this mode of explanation of how it is that enormous order and variety and complexity can be generated within a system and use it for the hardest questions in physics and biology? I'm going to turn the lights back on for a while. My theme is that to understand those questions and the question of what life is doing in the universe, we have to address many of the significant problems that face us as theoretical physicists. And we have to kind of take on them all as a package. And here are some of them. The first, which is the one that I work on professionally, how to unify quantum theory and general relativity. In the 19th century, there was this great physical theory, which was Newtonian mechanics. It explained, people believed, everything that could be understood in terms of physics, and we found out in the early 20th century was wrong, vastly wrong, but unfortunately it's been replaced twice, first by relativity and second by quantum theory. And rather than the view, which I think is too prevalent and we even teach too much, that there were these fortunate people at the beginning of the 20th century who got to participate in these great scientific revolutions that overthrew Newtonian mechanics and made relativity and quantum theory. Now we're just doing normal science in the particle physics or solid-state physics or something. I think the correct view is we're in the throes of a much larger transformation that's taking much longer, that is analogous to nothing else except the great transformation from Copernicus to Newton, which itself, we should recall, was 140 years, and is taking us from the Newtonian picture of the world, the Newtonian physics, to something quite different, of which relativity and quantum theory are pieces. And the fact that we don't yet understand how they're related to each other, or we don't yet have a theory that fits them together convincingly, tells us that that project isn't done. And that is the big project of the rest of 20th century science that will take us, hopefully, not till the 22nd century, but only till sometime in the next one, to solve. Then, related to that, of course, how to unify the different interactions of physics. The strong, the weak, nuclear forces, as well as electromagnetism and gravity. Another problem, at present, our understanding of physics is coded in something called the standard model of particle physics, which I'm not going to explain what it is. Okay. But the important thing about it is that while it's very beautiful and highly successful, so far it's not contradicted experimentally at all, unfortunately, it contains a large number of free parameters. These parameters refer to things like the masses of the different particles, the electron, the neutron, the proton, the neutrino, etc., the strengths of the electric charge, the strengths of the various nuclear forces. All of these things are unexplained at present, and are parameters that we put into the theory. Now, you might think that a good, convincing theory of elementary particle physics should tell us why the electron is almost 2,000 times lighter than the proton, but why the neutron is just a little bit heavier than the proton, for example. It's heavier than the proton by just 3 times the mass of the electron. And we think so, and for that reason, we think we don't have a final theory, or even a very good theory of elementary particles. We have a kind of catalog, and we know something about their interactions. and we're seeking to understand how are these numbers chosen. And we have no progress on that. We thought we had progress because in the middle 80s there was a beautiful theory, and still is a theory, called string theory, which seems to be the best attempt so far to unify the different interactions as well as give a partial solution to the first problem. And indeed it does, but our expectations for this theory were that it would also do something else, which was that this theory, by unifying the different interactions in quantum theory and relativity, there was a kind of expectation that this would be unique. And being unique, okay, would answer all the possible questions. So the questions about why the electrons and protons and neutrons come out the way they do would be answered by this one unique theory, because it would be the only mathematically consistent way to unify all these things. Very surprisingly, and one of the reasons why for sure science is not socially constructed, is that sometimes things come out not only against the expectations of one individual, but the whole bloody community, okay, is that it didn't come out that way. And in fact, string theory gives a consistent, to a certain approximation, I won't bore you with, unification of all these things, but it happens to come in about 100,000 different versions. Okay? And in those versions, space has different numbers of dimensions, and there are different kinds of elementary particles and different spectra of forces. Not only that, but most of those versions have free parameters in them as well. Okay? So that it seems that that problem, at least as far as we understand it, okay, doesn't lead to a unique solution. Then we have to face something that's pretty embarrassing, that a number of people have been pointing out for the last 30 or 40 years, among them Bob Dickey, Martin Rees, other people, which is that those values of those parameters, I'll call them, the things we don't understand, the masses and the strengths of the forces we don't understand, actually seem to be finely tuned, okay, so that, and I think this is what John Maynard Smith was referring to, so that life can exist. And more particularly, if you ask a milder question like, why are there the order of 100 different kinds of atomic nuclei which are stable? And that stability is an amazing thing when you know a bit too much about it, because you could worry why all those protons which have positive charges, okay, are stuck together because they want to repel each other. And indeed they do. Okay, and for that reason there's another force called the strong nuclear force which holds them together, but you don't want it to hold them together too well, or there wouldn't be interesting reactions amongst them. Okay? And in fact, if you could start to vary those parameters I mentioned, the strengths of the different forces or the masses of the different particles, you discover that it's very easy, okay, to vary them in such a way that atomic nuclei just fall apart and there aren't any. Okay? There, if you think of a space of parameters, and it's a high-dimensional space, there are about 17 of them, I haven't mentioned most of them, there's just a little box in that space, such that there are lots and lots of atomic nuclei. Now, of course, without there being lots and lots of atomic nuclei, there wouldn't be chemistry, because okay, there wouldn't be lots of different kinds of atoms, and there wouldn't be life, and by the way, there wouldn't be stars either, because stars are these things which burn and produce energy stably for on the order of billions of years. Okay. Now, that's important also for life. Not only do we have to have the ingredients, all the different chemical elements, okay, and of course, I'm not even mentioning the special cases of carbon, etc. I'll come to those. But we have to have a universe which is out of thermal equilibrium, because apart from what we learned in first year physics, the thermodynamics and the second law, okay, the universe is some billions of years old and it ain't in thermal equilibrium. And that's a very important fact for the existence of life. At least big regions of it are not in thermal equilibrium. And the reason is that there are stars that burn for billions of years, on the order of 10 billion years, that can produce, or as a consequence, we can have regions like the surface of a planet, which is out of equilibrium but has a steady flow of energy through it, which is what life is responsible for. So all of these are things we want to understand. Why are the parameters tuned, and not only that, apparently tuned to lead to a universe that's hospitable? Okay. Other questions, can we make sense? A completely different kind of question that I'll only get to mention, I don't think I'll have a chance to talk about it, but it's part of the whole picture that I'm trying to paint, is we don't understand quantum theory. Quantum theory works remarkably, but for sure it's a provisional theory, which is taking us from Newtonian physics to something else. And how one can be sure is that there's about a dozen different interpretations, and you can disagree profoundly about the interpretation and use the theory the same way, and indeed we do disagree, and indeed that's a famous problem on which there's been very little progress. And I think it's all the signs that trying to make sense of quantum mechanics is the wrong question to ask, and too many people, and I might say it here, too many philosophers have spent too much energy trying to solve that problem, and instead we should be trying to understand the physics problem of what's over-idealized and therefore wrong about the theory. All the formulations of quantum mechanics that I know that make sense, either explicitly or secretly through a lie through the back door, assume that you're studying a system which is isolated where the observers are outside the system. And therefore, when we try to unify relativity and quantum theory, we also try to take into account this other extraordinary fact we've learned, which is that the universe is not eternal and infinite, infinitely old, as even Einstein very stubbornly insisted as long as he could, okay, but finite in time and evolving in time, okay, and therefore, since we can understand that to some extent to a certain approximation again in general relativity, we want to understand that in the unification of general relativity and quantum theory. That means we have to be able to apply quantum theory to the whole universe, and that means that we have to get out of this idealization where we're studying a system apart from the observers. We have to face the fact that to do cosmology honestly, the observer is part of the universe. Okay. Now, I'm going to claim, and my main claim, one of my two main claims in this talk, is that all of these problems, which are indeed the key problems we face as theoretical physicists now, okay, are different aspects of this one problem I just mentioned, which is, can we do cosmology honestly? Can we extend theoretical physics from a study of isolated systems, okay, to a study of something that could be a whole consistent system? That, I claim, is the big question that this whole transformation, I claim, may be about. That is, a transformation from Newtonian physics to whatever we're doing. And so I'm going to propose some rather lofty and pretentious sounding, or you know, too ambitious sounding principles about this question, and then I'm going to show you sort of three applications. The third one I'll probably just get to mention, given time. So I think an important question to ask, and bear with me with the sort of philosophical part, is how must a theory which could be really a theory of the whole universe, a cosmological theory, differ from the theories that we have, like classical and quantum mechanics? And the answer is, the theory must make sense in the absence of this situation where we're studying an isolated system and we who are studying it are outside of it. That means it must make sense in the absence of external observers, reference systems, or some reference to some structures which are fixed and a priori and live outside the system. This is what we have to do. Okay. And how do we do it? Well, that's the second theme. My claim, and it's a big claim, and I hope that people will argue, is that in order to accomplish that, we in a sense have to make physics more Darwinian. That is, we have to take on this possibility that biology has shown to us, that a system can structure itself through quite comprehensible, rational, physical mechanisms like natural selection, as opposed to have their structure imposed on them from the outside, because there is no outside. Okay? So that's my theme. Now, here are my three overambitious, pretentious principles. Okay, the first one, and I'm going to spend a little time on the first, most of the time on the second, and I'll probably just mention the third. The first is an old theme philosophically, okay, that physical observables are relational. What that means is that anything that's physically meaningful is defined with respect to a background of other things that exist in terms of relationships between them. And I'll say exactly what that means for physics. Okay. Secondly, really what I just said, that historical processes of self-organization in this context are more explanatory than reliance on external laws that are held to be absolutely true. In some sense, what I want to say is that this move that theoretical physicists, we always want to sort of find what's absolute and what's eternally true, and that this is really a certain kind of mysticism or religion sneaking back in, the back door, through the history of science, for example, through Newton's theology, and we want to get rid of this, and replace that theology with science, which means replace the notion. For example, now that we know that at least our part of the universe was created sort of 15, 12 billion years ago, from some event we don't understand, but we do know that the whole thing was, that became all the things that we can see, was as dense at least as the interior of a star at some moment. Okay, we don't know quite how well we can trace back before that. Okay, but given that, it's all of a sudden very funny when people start telling us, yes, the universe began, there was nothing before the universe, it sprung into life, it began at some, quote, first moment of time, quote, the Big Bang, and then there were these eternally true laws of nature around to tell everything how to move. That's weird. And I think that weirdness we want to get rid of. Okay. Is everybody with me? Okay. I'm going to illustrate the first, and this is the hard part. I told John Maynard Smith it would be a hard part of the talk. It's not really about quantum gravity, it's about general relativity, and I'm going to explain general relativity to everybody in 5 minutes. Okay? So, what is really true about space and time and general relativity? A way to say this is, what are the beables? This is, or a more philosophically minded person, or from a certain tradition, would say, what are the observables? Okay. What are we talking about when we're talking about space and time in general relativity? There's this quote, this mythical thing called space-time, we're supposed to be curved and stuff like that. Okay. Well, the answer, and I'm going to try to say this in a way that even, you know, people who thought they could never understand something like this can understand it. The answer is supposed to be, there is this, space is this infinite continuum of points, okay, and there are different points, and that's a weird notion too, but you've all, you know, done geometry in school and learned to do it, and space-time is something like that with one more dimension. So a, quote, manifold, that's a pretentious technical term, of points, so there's a point P, okay, and there's various fields, like the electromagnetic field, the electric field, or the magnetic field, defined on it. So as you move around in the space, you can look at a point, say, Q, and at that point, there's some field, R, which tells you, R might tell you, for example, how much is the geometry curve or something, or psi might tell you how many electrons are there. Okay. And then there's some other point, P, and there are other things there. Okay. Now, not only is that what you're taught in school, that's what you're taught in graduate school when you study general relativity. Okay. That's completely wrong, and I owe my knowledge of this, and I should say I'm very, very happy to be giving this talk in front of numerous friends and colleagues, but among them Julian Barber, who convinced me of the point of view that I'm saying, and also Carlo Rovelli, who was very important in getting me to, helping me to think straight about this. That answer is completely wrong, and the reason is, okay, that it doesn't take into account the fact that the only thing that's observable is relationships, because what if, this has too many words on it, what if you were at the point Q and you looked at the relationships to everything around you, and the point P and you looked at the relationships of everything around you, and they were exactly the same? If we are obeying the principle that all that's true is relationships, then we shouldn't be able to distinguish those two points. Okay. And for that reason, because of implementing a slight, if you like, a philosophical principle that the only thing that's meaningful is observable relationships, that answer is wrong. And there's a technical answer, which is in the slide I took away, so it wouldn't scare you, called diffeomorphism invariant observables, okay, which just means, well, the only things that are true are those things that are defined in terms of relationships. Okay. Now, as Julian Barber and especially and other people have been arguing, okay, general relativity is precisely the manifestation of this principle, okay. And indeed, general relativity is true. That should be my next slide, if I push the right button. Okay. And let me turn the lights down for a moment. This is just my one slide proof that general relativity is true. I don't know if you can see it. General relativity predicts that space, as a result of being only about the relationships amongst things, that there's no absolute geometry, that geometry is an aspect of relationships and therefore changes when things move around. And as a result, if you have a cluster of galaxies there, the geometry of space can be deformed in such a way that it will act like a lens. And if you look carefully, and I don't know if everybody can see it, you can see this sort of several images of a blue galaxy that's up there and also slightly down, and it's spread out in a ring. And that's a photograph through Hubble of a gravitational lens that's taking an image of that blue galaxy behind this cluster of galaxies, and it's the Coma cluster, and, but I'm not sure, of course, and smush them out like a lens. So general relativity is true. Now, this principle goes back to an old philosophical argument, and it's due originally to, really, the philosopher Leibniz. And indeed, yes, here it is. I have a quote from Reichenbach telling us that, in fact, in general relativity, we've really realized Leibniz's principle. Now, who was Leibniz? Leibniz was a contemporary of Einstein, and he held strongly to this. I'm sorry, Newton. Thank you. That was just a test to see if you were listening. He held strongly to this relational point of view, and he fought and argued with Newton and his, I don't know what to call them, clones, and argued that we could only have, in the end, an understanding of space and time that was completely about relationships. And here Reichenbach, who's sort of a contemporary of ours, is telling us that, in fact, this famous correspondence, this was a fight between Leibniz and a student of his, Clark, read as though Leibniz has taken his expositions from Einstein's theory. And because of this, it's useful to actually think about what Leibniz said. And there is a quote of Leibniz that I'm just going to leave up in case people get bored with what I'm going to say, okay, because I'll come back to it. It really tells us the core of the relational philosophy, which now I'll try to say, quote, in my own words, okay, what Leibniz is saying there. I won't push you to read it. This is from the Monadology. What Leibniz is saying is that if it's true that what space and time are only aspects of relationships amongst things, okay, then the world has to be full of variety and complexity. Why? Because if we're to speak meaningfully of two places, where I am right now and where each of you is in this auditorium, and if they're to be distinct places, then it ought to be possible to distinguish them by their relationships with everything else, which means that the points of view that you see, each of you, when you look out at your world, have to be different from mine and different from each other's. And this means that the point of view, that is the view, you look around, you see various, you know, photons are coming to your eyes, and if you're really good, gravitons and neutrinos or whatever, you perceive them. Okay, and what you perceive from each point in space and each moment of time has to be different from every other one. Okay. And Leibniz understood that to maintain the view that space and time are just aspects of relations, that has to be an aspect of the world. That has to be true about the world. Now, it happens to be true of our world, as far as we can tell. Okay. For example, if you wanted to send one of these things where you send a satellite out into the universe and you hope that sometime in the next 10 billion years somebody will recover it and learn about us, okay, then you should put on it instructions for how to find us. Okay. And the only reliable way to do it, given that you don't know where they are and you don't know what their point of view, is not to try to draw a map of the universe with an arrow to "we are here," okay, because that would be unreliable in several respects. The really reliable way to do that is to just put a picture of our sky in. And then they look for the unique place in the universe and the unique time when there was a sky like that, with these bright stars or these bright galaxies around it. And Leibniz understood that principle. Okay. Now, first of all, I just want to make a sort of side remark. We have been finding that principle and this point of view very useful. This is not just philosophy. For example, those of us who do quantum gravity and try to understand what the quantum nature of space-time is, and this is a picture I brought because my friend Carlo Rovelli would be here and he drew it. Okay, this is a picture of a quantum state of space-time. It's a network of relationships. It's called a spin network because originally Roger Penrose invented the structure, but for a different purpose. And what has been discovered is that these code exactly the quantum states of space in the same way that discrete atomic energy levels code the quantum states of atoms. And we've learned the lesson that all of the information in these quantum states of space are about relationships. Because what could be nothing, in other words, the only thing that matters is the relationships of the points and the edges of the graphs to each other. And don't worry about the numbers. And we even use this, for example, I just thought I'd bring these along, trying to work with
this kind of quantum gravity, we have to make little toys, which are pictures of these networks that we use for calculations. We actually, so I thought I would just show these things. We actually use these things for calculations. So this is not philosophy, the only. It is philosophy, but is it the core of theoretical physics? If I thought I could pull it off in the time I have, I would try to explain to you that these gauge theories you may have heard of, which are behind this standard model of elementary particle physics, are also based on the principle that the only thing that's observable is relationships, that there is no absolute structures behind things. And we are learning slowly to do the physics and mathematics of these things. Okay. Now, that being said, let me return to this argument, which Leibniz understood, and I have a sense that people kind of forgot, which is that if space and time are to be relational, then the world must be complex. It must be full of variety, as I was saying, so that all the points are different, because that has an implication. And this will bring me back to my main theme. The implication is that the world starts in this Big Bang when everything is very hot and it expands, and it looks pretty uniform then. This is one of the things that we fight about as cosmologists, is exactly how uniform and why. Okay. But one of the big questions is, why has the universe come out not forever like a uniform gas in equilibrium? Okay. Why, in fact, does the universe have this characteristic that there are galaxies and stars and all of this structure and variety? There are big systems like the disks of galaxies which are out of equilibrium, okay, which, by the way, is another reason why we exist. The universe must, in fact, have mechanisms such that it goes into a situation in which it has a lot of variety and complexity. Because, and this is sort of the ideal or philosophical side of the argument, but I think it has teeth, this argument, okay, if space and time are only aspects of relationships, and if the world is this big thing which exists in space and time, then it had better be sufficiently complex that all those relationships distinguish all the points of space and all the moments of time. And therefore, to be consistent, whatever is at the heart of the world, the sort of heart of the elementary particles and their interactions, better guarantee that the world is full of complexity and structure and variety. That is, there had better be somehow in the structure of the fundamental laws something that guarantees that the world has sufficient variety and is not boring and uniform. Otherwise, there couldn't be space and time. Now, that's the argument that brings me back to my main theme, which is supposing we buy this for a moment. You can argue with me afterwards, but buy it for the moment. Okay? Where are we to find mechanisms by which a big system like the universe, which, as I've already emphasized, has to be something that develops on its own without having any structure imposed on it, where are we to find mechanisms by which this can become organized over time? So that Leibniz's view of space and time is coherent, as it seems to be, because general relativity is verified. Okay. Where are we to find them? And the only thing I've been able to think of worrying about this is we steal them from the only people who have studied the problem in any context of how a system can generate structure and variety. That is, we steal it from the biologists. Okay. And the rest of my time, I'm going to talk about one such crime. Okay. So this brings me back. So I really think that there are arguments that take you from the basic problems about quantum theory and what are space and what are time to having to have built into the what the laws of nature are mechanisms which are analogous to those mechanisms that build structure and complexity in biology. That's what I'm looking for. Okay. And now I'll tell you about one very hypothetical proposal to commit that crime and steal from the biologists. Okay. Now, remember I told you about all these special tunings of the parameters, the masses. Let's come back to that problem. Why the masses of all the particles are what they are. Okay. What could account for them? Well, as I told you, apparently fundamental theory doesn't account for them. That is, as far as we know, all the different theories, that the problem of unifying the different interactions leads to a highly non-unique result. It leads to the order of approximation that string theory is reliable to.
So it seems that there's not some Platonic thing that there's some one best or most, you know, or consistent, only one equation consistent with relativity and quantum theory, and that's the world. It seems that there's choice. What other types of explanations are available for this? Well, a very popular one, which has been much discussed, is the anthropic principle, which says in its scientific versions, and I won't discuss its theological versions, which is for theologians to discuss. In the scientific versions, it says the universe comes in enormous numbers of versions in which these different parameters are different, okay? And we just happen to live in that one for which it comes out right. That is, it comes out with the values of all the masses such that there can be lots of atomic nuclei and stars and chemistry and so forth. Well, I don't think that's a scientific explanation. First of all, it pushes the imagination, because if you ask in appropriate units, you put the parameters all in appropriate units for fundamental physics, and you ask what's the chance that you chose them all by randomly and they fall in the little box where there's carbon chemistry, and it's sort of one chance in 10 to the 228, at least when I did the calculation. So that requires that there be more than that number of versions of the universe. And it doesn't explain anything. So what I want to tell you about is a proposal from quantum gravity to explain that. And so I'm going to go back and borrow two ideas from quantum gravity, which I claim give us an approach to answering this question, which commits the crime of stealing from biology. And so what this problem has to do with is what happens in black holes. And this is sort of the last time in this talk you have to learn something new. I know I've tried people's patience a lot, okay? But everybody's heard of black holes. The important thing to understand is that a black hole is a very common, ordinary thing. It happens whenever you have a collection of material which has so massive that it has no way of supporting itself that it collapses continually. And at some point in the collapse, it reaches a point where light can't escape. And the reason is very simple. For every body, there is a speed that you have to go if you want to leave it, called the escape velocity. You have to start out with that speed if you hope to leave the body. Okay? And if you take something and you shrink it, as it shrinks, the escape velocity gets larger. So if there's something that can't be, that there's no mechanism that can stop it shrinking, at some point its escape velocity passes the speed of light, and nothing can escape, not light nor anything else, because nothing can travel faster than light. And that's a black hole, and they're very common in the universe. They happen whenever a very massive star, and it's an interesting fact about the universe that there are a great many stars significantly more massive than the sun. They live for very short times, unlike our sun, like 1 million years or 10 million years. And whenever any one of these very massive stars runs out of nuclear fuel, it explodes in a supernova, there's a remnant left over, and that collapses. And if it's too massive to be what's called a neutron star, which is something that sustains itself because it collapses down to the density of an atomic nucleus and then stops, if it's too massive for that, it just keeps going and makes a black hole. And that's happening something like 100 times per second in the universe out to the range that we can observe. It's happening something like once every few hundred years in each galaxy like our own, but there's 10 to the 11 galaxies. So it's a very, very common event. And it raises the question of what happens at that collapse, because according to what we understand, that remnant of a star just keeps down collapsing until it has infinite density, which takes very short time, and then it stops. And Roger Penrose proved in what's called the singularity theorems in the middle 60s that general relativity has no alternative. There's no way to get out of that. And the star will collapse to infinite density no matter what, however, no matter whether it was rotating or whatever chaos was going on. And then time stops, according to general relativity. It's the inverse of the, quote, time beginning of the Big Bang. So what really happens? We know that general relativity isn't the right theory. We know it's not. We know it has to be combined with the other interactions in quantum theory. And an old idea is that at some point there's some explosion due to some new quantum effect, and it begins to expand again. And this is called the bounce hypothesis, and it goes back at least to Johnny Wheeler in the 60s in the context of talking about the collapse of the universe, the whole universe collapsing. It goes back at least to Tolman in the 20s, I believe. West 30s.
Relatively thermodynamics cosmology.
Please?
Relatively thermodynamics.
Yes.
35.
Okay. So it's an old idea. If it bounces, we can't see it, because what's happened is there's this surface beyond which light can't escape, and that's still there. That's called the horizon. So this happens to the future somewhere of that, and this space and time begins to expand. Okay, the star explodes and begins to expand and can get as big as it likes. Now, at this point, everybody says, but wait a minute, there's only a certain amount of energy. Isn't energy and matter conserved? But the answer is that you don't need very much energy, because as the thing expands, it can get energy to create as much matter as it likes from actually the gravitational energy, because you have stuff that is getting further and further away. Okay, and you know gravitational potential energy is negative. Okay? If you're worrying about this question, you know enough to know that gravitational potential energy is negative, I hope. Okay, so that it's the energy that if you let the thing recollapse again, it would gain. So you actually don't need to input very much energy at all so that the whole thing could expand and become as big as our universe. Okay. And in fact, the hypothesis is that that happens in every black hole, and that our universe is the result of such a thing that happened in a black hole in the previous thing. So that's the bounce hypothesis that I'm taking. I also want to take another idea due to Johnny Wheeler, which is that when that happens, the laws of physics in the new region are somewhat different than the old region. He called it reprocessing the universe. And I only want to add, and this I got from reading Richard Dawkins, I'm very honored and scared that he's here watching this, that to get anything interesting to happen, that change has to be small to get the accumulation of change. So let that change be small. That is, let the masses of the various elementary particles and the strengths of the forces differ only slightly in the new region than the old. And I don't have any explanation for why you should believe that, although quantum gravity and string theory are advancing very quickly to the point where I think in a few years we might have. Okay. Well, that has consequences. And given what's happening to time, not only here but generally, rather than put a slide with a technical argument, I'll put a slide with a picture, which at least for the biologist will explain the argument that follows, okay, which is that you have a landscape. Okay, these are the space of parameters, which is like the different values of the genes. And again, I learned this from Richard Dawkins. You have a landscape, which is the fitness landscape, that in this case tells you, on the average, how many black holes will be made by a universe created in this way with these values of the masses and other parameters. Okay. Our universe makes at least a billion billion, at least 10 to the 18 black holes by best estimates. Okay, it's very easy to see that, it's very easy to convince yourself that there's lots of choices of these constants so that nothing ever interesting ever happens. You don't ever get enormous amounts of matter collected together, so you get black holes and the landscape is low, and you make really accidentally somewhere might make one or two or something. In this rendition, a universe is like a cat. You just let them reproduce themselves over and over again. The higher they are in the landscape, the more they reproduce themselves. They spread their progeny around. You come back a long time later and you say, where are we most likely to be if we're in some region of space and time? And the answer is in some one whose parameters are near the top. And that's the whole argument. Okay. I claim that this may be seen to be desperate, I claim I have various lofty philosophical arguments I gave that there might be something like this, but I claim that it's not philosophy, it's science, just like ideas about space and time having to be relational are not philosophy, they're testable science, and this is testable. And I want to end shortly, so let me just explain briefly how it's testable and why it's something that can really be discussed. The point is that if you believe this, then what you believe is that almost any change in a parameter should lead you to a world that makes less black holes. And that's something that you can check. You can't check it in a laboratory, obviously, but you can go to your friends, astronomers. You can even use this to make friends with astronomers. I'm very glad to have learned And you can say, supposing I raise the neutron mass a little bit, would I have a world with more black holes or less black holes? And Martin Rees is here. We played this game a lot, not as much as I would have liked to, but some. And you can reason, given that we know about the processes that make black holes, okay, which, as I said, predominantly, as far as we know, come from massive stars. So we have to worry about the processes that both make massive stars and the processes by which massive stars get rid of their mass, because they turn out to evaporate a lot of their mass during their life, and then they explode and throw out more of it. And then you have to worry about how much mass do you have to have left over at the end so that you don't become a neutron star. And by worrying about these things, you can test the theory. And to kill the theory, all that you have to do is find a plausible argument, a good argument, that one way of changing the parameters leads to a world with more black holes. Okay. Now, my impression is, having played this game, is that first of all, it's a bit harder than it looks. And the reason is that galaxies where black holes are made are not, let me see if this will work, otherwise I have it on the slide, maybe that works. That's a typical spiral galaxy where stars are made at a constant rate, some of those leading to black holes. And those systems, which we have to understand to run this argument, turn out themselves to be rather complex systems out of thermal equilibrium in a very interesting state. There turns out to be a kind of ecology of these systems. There is a medium which exists in several different phases, okay, of gas and dust, and there are stars of differing masses. There are short-lived, very massive, very luminous energetic stars and normal stars like our sun, okay, which live for a long time and are not very energetic. And there's a whole kind of set of processes by which energy is exchanged amongst the different phases of this medium and between the medium and the stars. Just to scare people, enormous simplification of the diagram of the reaction network of the galaxy. And you have to worry about what happens when you mess with that. Now, I want to come to an end, so let me just say that the most interesting thing I've learned asking this question is that stars, massive stars, are formed because there are clouds in this medium which refrigerate themselves to incredibly cold temperatures and high densities. That is, they kind of self-refrigerate to about on the order of 10 degrees above absolute zero. And if you ask, and it is from these very dense clouds that you get the formation of the massive stars that become eventually some of them black holes. And if you ask how that can be, that there are processes that efficiently refrigerate these clouds and galaxies, the answer turns out to rest largely on carbon chemistry. There is carbon monoxide in those clouds. There is also dust, which shields them and is made up of silicates and carbon and water, ice, that is the sites on which carbon monoxide is formed. And that carbon monoxide rotates and radiates energy, and that's the mechanism, or the prime mechanism. Everything in astronomy is six times more complicated than they tell you at first, but it's the primary mechanism by which these things refrigerate themselves. So the same chemistry that makes life possible makes galaxies go and makes massive stars be formed, and therefore it leads to black holes. Therefore, the same set of arguments that say if you change the parameters, you disrupt the possibility of a universe having life, tell you that you also disrupt having a universe that makes lots of black holes. So one is able to steal not only from the biologists, but from people like Martin Rees, who have developed all those arguments in the context of the anthropic principle. Okay. So that is the style of it. I believe at the present time that there are 9 good arguments that changing the parameters makes making black holes less likely, and sort of 5 ones where you can't really tell, and no good arguments for increasing the number of black holes. It's also possible, and I don't have time to go into this, to make predictions, like if astronomers ever see a neutron star with a high mass as much as 3 times the mass of the sun, this theory would be very hard to sustain. So this theory makes real predictions and could be easily killed next week by some astronomers. Okay. Yet, the theory, and I'll go on a limb and say this is the only theory, okay, of where the parameters of elementary particles physics come from so far that makes sufficiently tight predictions that it could be killed by observation. So it is a real theory. It may be right, it may be wrong. Okay. Let me close by going back, and unfortunately there's all sorts of wonderful things I didn't get to tell you about, but let me go back to the basic issue, which is how is a cosmological theory possible? And what I've argued is that a cosmological theory has to be a theory in which things that, broadly speaking, modes of explanation that refer to something outside the system, either to give something meaning, to talk about observing the system, or to talk about how structure develops or how choices are made, okay, why are these laws of physics true rather than some other set of laws of physics, okay, all of these questions, to go to cosmology, we have to change our mode of explanation from what we've been used to in theoretical physics, which is always, when you analyze it, going outside the system, to a mode of explanation where you go inside the system and ask for the answer to the question being solely from inside the system. And my contention is, first of all, that general relativity tells us that this is the right direction, okay, that is, general relativity is largely a realization of this. And second, that alternative modes of explanation, i.e. the search for a unique theory of everything, have gone in a funny way because there seem to be thousands or hundreds of thousands of possible unifications which are equally consistent. So we're not going to get explanations for why the universe is one way rather than another way from that. Okay, and that we have a possibility, if we're willing to steal from the only people who have invented explanations as to how systems without outside intervention can make choices and develop structure, if we steal from them, we have the possibility of inventing theories that have real predictive power and therefore real explanatory power. I want to end with the last quotation of Dick Feynman, who I think anticipated all of this with this quotation. And I'll stop there, and if there's time for questions, take questions. Thank you.
I can't resist saying that when I hear astronomers or people who know about astronomy talking about what's up there, they sound just like natural historians talking about the organisms you find in a forest. I mean, there really is all that odd variability out there, and it's very encouraging. I think that's about the only part of your talk I really felt I understood. But we have a little time for questions. Yeah.
Yes, John, you're very lovely. In the case of biological evolution, we have some idea of what the world was like before life evolved, and therefore some possibility of speculation how the process got started. Obviously, a question that arises from your fascinating account is if there's any possibility that we could ever know how a system like this could have been started. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, the comment that I have about that question, and many people have asked about it, the question is how could the whole thing have gone started, is that in science, whatever we are, I mean, I have lots to say about the first talk, but whatever we are, okay, we're opportunists, and we try to find questions that we can solve. And I think that there are certain questions which are solvable at a given time and certain questions which we just don't know nearly enough. It may just be, really, if we stretch things, okay, that the question about the origin of life is a serious scientific question these days. I've been interested in it. Okay. I certainly have the impression that the analogous questions for cosmology, given this or given whatever scheme you like, inflationary hypothesis and so forth, okay, we're not there. Okay. We are doing incredibly well. Okay. For example, the MAP and the Planck satellites are going to measure the cosmic black body radiation in about 5 years to such a precision, we're going to have real checks of theories of sort of the first 10 to the minus 20th seconds in quotes in these inflationary things. So, I mean, we're doing tremendously well, but there are things that are way beyond the horizon, and that's one of them. I should do it. This gentleman here. Yes.
Just with reference to the great
the reference to the previous question, maybe it's an infinite rebirth.
Would you like to stand up and talk loudly? Sorry.
Yeah, the phrase question, perhaps it could be an infinite rebirth. It's in the sense of metaphysical absolute, to say what was the beginning. If you have an anesthetude of space-time, then it's not obviously the first member of the series. Just two questions I'd like to ask. First of all, what about the first law of thermodynamics and your collapsing black holes? Is that equivalent to inflation? You're simply creating mass energy for nothing, which seems to violate the energy of momentum sensitivity. The other thing, I read a book by Joseph Silk, the cosmologist. He's suggesting that only hot clouds can generate large stars because the kinetic energy of the average constituents of the cloud is such that you need quite a large gravitational field over a large region in order to collapse them into a hot star. Otherwise, the cloud would fragment into smaller, cooler stars. Cold clouds tend to produce low mass stars, and hot ones, you need a large volume of material in order to collapse because of the kinetic energy.
You'll have to repeat.
Of the two questions, let me answer. I was thinking so hard about the second one. The second one is a question about astronomy. Maybe it's warm clouds that collapse to massive stars. And I think I would defer to Martin. I mean, my education from astronomers is you need giant molecular clouds to get massive stars. What's questionable is light stars, whether they could arise otherwise. But there have been these arguments about fragmentation. Martin is the author of some of them. So, do you want to comment or?
Yeah. Martin, yeah.
May I just comment? I think we know very little about star formation. It's very hard to assess this. Can I mention two words I have about this whole story?
Yeah.
One is that in the bounce that happens when the black hole collapses, etc., physically you can identify an arrow of time so that you can really talk about things evolving in time from one universe to the next. Which I thought one of the uncertainties whether you define time for the bounce. The other is that it's not clear to me that the universe that is best for making black holes is really the universe that is best for life. If it isn't, then you are back to an anthropic constraint as well as your constraint. And that second issue does, I think, depend very much on whether you are right about this very complicated picture of star formation. Because, to give one example, supposing you kept physics the same, except that you turned off all nuclear energy sources, then I would expect that it's easier. Any star too big to be a white dwarf will just quite quickly deflate and become a black hole. If that were the case, then that would be a universe bad for life, which is better for black holes than our present universe. Now, the only way you have around that argument is to appeal to this very complicated flowchart and say that massive stars don't form.
Yes.
The elements. And so I think you're very far from being able to test your theory empirically simply because the star formation process is not really very well understood.
Yes. Well, I agree with the last part. I mean, I think we try to do our best. So several questions. I'll come back to your question also. The arrow of time. The question. I mean, this is a quantum gravity question, and there are those of us who work on quantum gravity who think that time somehow disappears in the regime under question, like Julian Barber, and those of us who think that time continues, and we're not. Hopefully this will be resolved, this kind of question will be resolved when we really have not just a string theory, what's a perturbative unification, but a real non-perturbative understanding. About the question about life, my attitude is it might be that we're not quite all the way up the hill, as indeed that picture shows, because if we went absolutely to the top, we would still have carbon chemistry, and so forth. Maybe the properties of water wouldn't be quite right for origin of life to get started or something. Okay, if we get to the point where, look, there are more than 20 parameters in question between elementary particle physics and cosmology. If we get to the point that there's a good argument that we're near a peak, in 19 of those parameters, and there's one more direction to go in that takes us a little bit up to another peak where, however, life would not be possible, I would be enormously happy.
So, get 19 out of 20 of them right.
And before then, I think it's hard to distinguish. Last point, as far as conservation of energy, as I try to suggest, it's really not a problem. And that's a standard thing even in Newtonian physics, that a system can have zero energy and have as many things in it as it likes and be as big as it likes. Just because...
Let me step in as the chairman. Because I'm aware of the fact that there are drinks which are really important to me, I'm only going to allow one more question, and the rest will have to be to Lee over the drinks.
Okay.
Well, Richard, you've not had a question. Why don't you ask a deep question?
I too had been worried about the point that Martin Rees raised, and why is it that a universe that's good at making black holes is good at making people? And I mean, I can think of a weak answer, which is that both processes need time. So we're looking for a way in which is not just a plain luck. Both processes need a long time, but that's pretty weak. That'll probably tame your 10 to the 228 somewhat, but only somewhat. The strong answer might be that universes come to an end not just in black holes, but when civilized intelligences, physicists in other words, start messing about and creating black holes, which have exactly the properties you're talking about. So maybe life is not merely a consequence of universes, but a cause of them.
Yeah, so the second point, you may or may not be aware of it, but there is a literature. I hate to... Okay, there's a literature proposing something like that, some in this context, some not. Indeed, I guess my attitude is the same as what I said to Martin. That is, what would be very important would be to look for ways to test this idea that are independent of the conditions required for life. What I was hinting about with neutron stars, let me just advertise, is such a test. The parameter in question is the mass of the strange quark, which can be independently verified, independent of the conditions required for life, and it requires something rather unlikely, which is that parameter be set so that there be neutron stars there be as few neutron stars as possible, because they would go unstable if they were more than a certain mass. And I think that's a strong test of the theory. The rest of it, I agree with Martin. The extent to which the picture is really true that we need carbon chemistry strongly to make massive enough stars to become black holes is a key part of the question. My understanding is it's a reasonable hypothesis given what's known from astronomy, but the process of star formation is very much under development and study, both observationally and theoretically. And since this is science, I'm very happy to say, maybe this will even close it, that in the future we'll know more, which is what's good about science.
Well, my first and very pleasant duty is to give you a present from the Darwin Center.
Okay, thank you very much.
And I would like to thank both Lee and our two other speakers today for giving us a fantastic day. Thank you very much. I won't keep you more than 2 minutes, but just 2 minutes if you can bear with me. First of all, I do find it rather encouraging in a world in which we are always told that academics never talk to one another, that one could come to the London School of Economics of all places and listen to the talk that I've heard. It was a real pleasure that one was here to hear it. Thank you very much. Just a few announcements. First of all, and most important, you're all invited to drinks on the top floor of the Student Cafe, and I'm incredibly assured that stewards will point you in the right direction. Secondly, and importantly, I'd like to thank Weidenfeld, the publishers, for actually providing the tea and the drinks. Thank you very much indeed. And thirdly, I'd like to draw your attention to that notice of an additional Darwin event on 9th of June. Thank you very much.